You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
Yo, check this out, man.
For a minute that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. Who, you know, the only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only answer.
Gonna rise up, take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This week in Radical History for the week starting August 4th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found in the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
As reported in the San Francisco Herald on this date, August 4th, 1869, San Francisco land speculator Emperor Norton I declares the United States dissolve, and the greatest and wise ruler of the United States abolishes both Democratic and Republican parties. He's quoted in the paper as saying, "Party strife now exists within the realm. I do hereby dissolve and abolish Democratic and Republican parties, and also do hereby decree the disfranchisement and imprisonment for not more than 10 years and no less than 5 years to all persons leading to any violation of this your imperial decree." So remember, when you go out and vote Democrat or Republican this coming year, you're going to be in violation of the emperor's decree. Wouldn't want to do that now. In other empire news, in 1925 on this date, U.S. Marines leave Nicaragua after 13 years of occupation. Don't worry, they'll be back again and again. Also on August 4, 1944, Netherlands, Nazi police in Amsterdam, acting on an informant's tip, discover Anne Frank and the family in hiding. The eight lived in a single secret room for 728 days, then were sent to the notorious Belsen concentration camp where they were killed except the father. He returned to the house after the war and found Anne's diary. Began at age 12, he recorded the feelings and thoughts, pressures and fears, while coming to age during 2 years of hiding from death. Translated in over 30 languages, is a symbol of strength and how brutal humans can be to other humans. People, the time
has come. This is your Radio Ritz reporter, Jackie Cook. On this day, August 4th, in 1964, the bodies of American civil rights activists James Chaney, Michael Schwerner, and Andrew Goodman were found in the Mississippi River after disappearing 2 months earlier. The three young activists had traveled together to Mississippi to register black voters and investigate the bombing of a black church. After being arrested for supposed speeding, they were released onto a dark, remote road and greeted by carloads of Ku Klux Klan members. The Klansmen shot the two Jewish New Yorkers, Schwerner and Goodman. Chaney, a black Mississippi native, was brutally beaten with chains and mutilated before being shot. The killings received massive media attention and ignited public sympathy, but civil rights activists criticized the publicity, stating that had two of the victims not been white, the case would have been largely ignored. Can you think of any other cases like this? Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Lastly, on August 4th, 1988, Congress votes 20,000 each Japanese Americans in turn during World War II. This week in Radical History for August 5th, 1498. What? No kangaroos? Columbus is the first recent European to land in South America continent, and he thinks he landed in Australia. Speaking of colonization in the New World, in this date in 1620, the Mayflower and Speedwell sail away and also do not find Australia. Unfortunately for Native American, they find them instead. Also on August 5th, 1892, Harry Tubman gets a pension from Congress for her work as a nurse, spy, and scout during the Civil War. She, along with Sojourn Truth and Susie King and almost 200 other African-American women, served as nurses during the war in 11 hospitals in over three states. Also on August 5, 1936, James Colton, who married anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman in 1925 to provide her with British citizenship, dies of cancer. Colton, an elderly anarchist from Wales, married Emma so she'd be free from the problems of traveling and giving lectures. Also on this date, 1964, U.S. begins bombing of North Vietnam to protect American interests, of course.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on August 5, 1990, Bush sends U.S. Marines into Liberia to protect American interests.
And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality.
This week in Radical History for August 6th, 1855, Bloody Monday riots. A Louisville, Kentucky mob pulling a brass cannon attacks Irish Quarter, burning down houses and killing at least 20, the Irish being the Mexicans of our day. Also on August 6, 1890, on Good Friday, of course, the first electric chair execution in the United States happens in Auburn Prison in New York. It was a gruesome execution. It had to be done over and over again. And no, he did not rise in 3 days. Also on August 6, 1927, Massachusetts High Court hears final plea for those anarchist bastards, Sutko and Vizzetti. Protest bombs hit homes of Baltimore mayor and Boston mayor. Their controversial trial attracted numerous international attention, with critics accusing the prosecution and presiding judge of improper conduct, like calling them those anarchist bastards, and allowing of anti-Italian, anti-immigrant, and anti-anarchist sentiment to prejudice the jury. Prominent Americans such as Upton Sinclair publicly sided with the citizen-led opposition to the verdict. The two executed elicited mass protests in New York, London, Amsterdam, Tokyo. Workers walked out across South America, and riots in Paris, Geneva, and Germany, as well as Johannesburg, occurred. Also on August 6, 1945, U.S. drops atomic bomb on a civilian population of Hiroshima, U.S. being the only country to use this massive type of WMD. Destroying homes of almost 400,000 people, the bomb explodes in the air and destroys more than two-thirds of the city's buildings. About half the population is burned in ruins, burned to death by the explosive heat or consumed by fire. Thousands of survivors develop radiation sickness, and in 1 month, hundreds more would die in makeshift hospitals and other weakened buildings crumble around them. There is no practical reason to drop the bomb. It did nothing to shorten the war, and Japan was already trying to negotiate peace with the United States. The United States is simply determined to show Russia who is calling a tune in the post-World War. Also on August 6, 1957, 11 activists from the Committee of Nonviolence Action arrested at Atomic Test Proving Grounds in Nevada, the first of what eventually become thousands arrested in Nevada test site and hundreds of thousands around the world. Also on that date, 1967, Indian Claims Commission awards $12.2 million to 8 Lakota tribes for 29 million acres, most of them in the Upper Great Plains, taken by fraudulent treaties. Also on that date, 1985, USSR begins unilateral moratorium on nuclear testing. U.S. responds by conducting more underground nuclear tests. Then in 1989, U.S. expressed moral outrage at India and Pakistan for similar testing. Also on August 6, 1988, Tompkins Square Park police riot in New York. A videotape of the police riot got five cops indicted, the chief retired, the captain moved out of the ninth precinct, and more cops were disciplined and some fired. Lastly, on this date, in 1990, UN Security Council imposed economic sanctions in Iraq. Total deaths of children under age 5 from the cause of sanctions from 1990 to November 1999 was 502,495 deaths of children. This week in Radical History for August 7th, 1854. Rumor that all Catholic churches were arsenals brings a mob of axe-wielding Protestants to St. Louis House of Worship. 8 Irish were butchered like cattle and 30 more seriously wounded, the Irish being the Mexicans of our day. Also on August 7, 1960, Fidel Castro announces plans to nationalize all American holdings. U.S. and the Mafia, which controlled the economy, fights back. And U.S. government takes the moral high ground and begins a nonstop campaign to assassinate Fidel Castro. Also on this date, 1967, Gulf of Tonkin resolution in response to a falsely report of attacks U.S. destroyer passes the House 416-0 and the Senate 88-2. Giving LGB extraordinary powers, authorizing him to use all necessary steps to win the war in Vietnam. Only two legislatures, Morris and Running, vote against it, with no opposition in the House. Then the FBI begins collecting the names of supporters of Morris, and his office phone lines are tapped. Same war, different year. Also on that date, 1978, the Love Canal subdivision, Niagara Falls, New York, built on a site of former Harker Chemical Company chemical dump, formally declared a toxic disaster area by President Carter. Also on this date, 1979, highly enriched uranium released from a top-secret nuclear fuel plant near Irwin, Tennessee. About 1,000 people are contaminated with up to five times as much radiation they would normally receive in any given year. Lastly, for August 7, 1995, due to international pressure, state of Pennsylvania announces the stay of its planned August 17th execution of political prisoner Mumia Ojemil. U.S. officials have vowed to silence Mumia at all costs and take extraordinary actions to do so. NPR buckles under the pressure from the right wing. Temple University in Philadelphia, owners of seven Pennsylvania radio stations, also buckles under pressure, refuses to air tapes in defense of him, cancels contract with Pacifica Network. Free press? Yeah. This week in radical history for August 8th, 1449. Portuguese slaver Henry the Navigator unloads six ship of human cargo slaves from Africa. He proclaims it is the, quote, salvation, unquote, of their souls. Also on August 8th, 1879, Mexico, revolutionary hero, anarchist Emilio Zapata lives. He'll inspire the Zapatista movement. Zapata will continue to live as long as the people believe that they have the right to their own lands and the right to govern themselves according to their own deeply held beliefs and cultural values. Also on August 8, 1925, a huge KKK rally held in Washington, D.C. The modern-day KKK, known as skinheads, with all the right-wing anti-immigrant sentiment, skinheads are increasing in numbers around the United States and the world. Also on this date, 1942, India National Congress passes Quit India Resolution, leading to mass arrests by their British masters. Two more items for August 8, 1974. Tricky Dick Nixon, no longer claiming he is a crook, announces he'll resign. Said, "I am not a quitter." Then he quits. Also claimed during the Vietnam War to be a pacifist. Guess he got that one wrong, too. Also on that date, 1980, Reagan aide William Casey leaves on a second trip to bribe Iranians to delay the release of U.S. hostage until Reagan takes office. Only got a couple items this week in radical history for August 9th, 1779. General Clinton and 1,500 American troops break dam and flood the Iroquois towns and fields in upstate New York. Troops then burn and ravage settlement for 12 days. Also on that date, 1945, America Fat Boy dropped on Nagasaki. About 70,000 more civilians die immediately. Truman drops the bomb to prove to Russia that he's tough and gets the Cold War arms race off to an unhealthy start. Also on August 6, 1966, 200 sit-in in New York City's offices of Dow Chemical Company to protest the use of napalm in Vietnam. Edward Abbey would say, "A patriot must always be ready to defend his country against his government." Lastly, for August 9, 1997, New York City cops rape and torture Abner Louima, a legal immigrant from Haiti, sodomize him with a plunger. New York cops always practice their own unique form of justice. This week in radical history for August 10th, only got a couple items. 1877, U.S. Army troops under Colonel Gibson attack a sleeping Nez Perce encampment at Big Hole, Idaho, killing over 50 women and children. Also on August 10th, 1893, Chinese are deported from San Francisco under the first Chinese Exclusion Act to exclude Chinese workers from the United States. The Chinese being Irish of that day, the Chinese and Irish being the Mexicans of our day. 1968, eight American GIs killed by U.S. strafing air in Vietnam. Quote, "Vietnam was the first war ever fought without censorship of the media. Without censorship, things can go terribly confusing in the public mind," unquote. General William Westmoreland, U.S. military commander. Lastly, on a state in 1981, the closing of the Nixon Museum, says manager Pete Mitchell, quote, "If nothing else, it's been a good stopping point for people to use the restrooms between Los Angeles and San Diego." This has been This Week in Radical History. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Organizer, thanks to some audio borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York, and more radical info came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. Thanks for listening to this week's This Week in Radical History, produced at the Glee Glee Studios. And as always, until next week, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
A voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, "God, I voted."
تمتضي فوز قزح طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where you hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, which is so often missing in the news and analysis as presented in the Western media. This week, the entire program is given over to the featured Palestinian voice of activist Nidal al-Azraq. Nidal, born and raised in the Ida refugee camp in Bethlehem, now lives in the Boston area, where he is executive director of the nonprofit organization One for Three, which focuses on working to bring clean water to the West Bank of Palestine in the face of incredible shortages due to the discriminatory water policies of Israel, which completely controls all flow of water in both Israel and Palestine. We sat down with Nidal in this extended conversation to discuss his people and his work. Nidal, thank you for your willingness to speak to us on This Week in Palestine. We want to talk with you this morning about the place where you grew up, where much of your family lives to this day, and the place to which you return with great regularity. And that is the Ida refugee camp in Bethlehem in the West Bank of Palestine. You, your wife and daughter now live in the greater Boston area, but we know your heart is always with your people in the Ida camp. Is that safe to say?
That is very safe to say, yes.
Ida seems to be of constant concern to the Israeli military these days. It's a place where the resistance to occupation is alive and well, and therefore it's become a flashpoint for military intrusions on a regular basis. Tell us about Ida. What is going on there to merit such a pushback by the Israeli military?
Well, first, the last report for the United Nations that came out considered Ida to be the second most tense refugee camps in the West Bank after Shafat camp in Jerusalem. And this is due to its location, geographic location in Bethlehem City. You know, Ida camp is next to an Israeli military base, which is surrounded by Rachel's tomb, and is very close to one of the major settlements in the West Bank, which is Gilo settlement. And this is why Israel decided to surround this wall, this camp with 8-meter concrete wall from two sides, and a military base from the third side. But this goes back, you know, historically, even in the First Intifada, but we don't want to go all the way to the First Intifada. Let's start from 2004. And this is when new generation, the young youth and even children in the camps starting to jump in into the resistance. Unfortunately, if we remember the second intifada that started in 2000, if we look carefully about what happened and the ideology or the plan that Israel implemented on the Palestinians, Israel succeeded in cleaning the Palestinian streets from the good active leaderships through assassinations, through arrests and sentencing them to life sentence and sending them to the exile. So practically what Israel did is to leave the Palestinian streets to the Palestinian Authority, which unfortunately they have done nothing to help the Palestinians during that time, especially the youth and the young generations. So this young generation that I'm talking about, which I have been following for the past, actually 12 years, intensively following them, not only in Ida camp, but in other refugee camps across the West Bank, was born, you know, during the Oslo period, did not witness the first intifada, only heard about the glory and amazing stories about the first uprising in mid-80s and early 90s, but lived and witnessed the brutality of the second intifada that started in 2000.
You were how old at this point?
In which one?
In the first intifada, you were...
Well, the first Intifada, let's say, born in 78 and 87, 86, we're talking about, you know, 10, 11, 13 years old, growing up to 14 years old.
That's the first one.
Yeah. And, yeah, in early mid-20s in the second Intifada, that started.
Was that much more visible in Ida Camp than the first Intifada? Because you said you weren't that aware of the first Intifada?
No, I was very aware. I was aware of the first Intifada, but the generation that really was born during the Oslo period did not really witness anything of the first Intifada.
Yeah.
Only heard about the amazing stories that happened back then.
Right.
But no, I remember everything. I even participated at a young age in the first Intifada, as many, many kids and youth, especially in the early 90s, before Oslo came. So this young generation grow up, you know, up to 2004, they were like 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, and not much going on for them in other refugee camp. And during that time, Israel started building the wall around Ida camp. And here this generation really took the lead in resisting the occupation inside the camp and around the camp, and trying to manage to stop the wall around the camp. And they did. I remember in 2004, they really managed to stop the construction on the wall for completely like 2 weeks, which drove the Israelis nuts.
How did they do that? With just active resistance?
It's active the resistance, ongoing, non-stop demonstrations that include, of course, throwing stones and Molotov cocktails and confrontations with the Israeli army every single day, 7 days a week, non-stop, for months and months and months. During that time, they did not stop, which led to the Israelis back then, they were really going crazy about that. And this is why the Mukhabarat, you know, made the decision is to arrest most of the teenagers in our refugee camp. And they sure did. I remember sometimes around 2004 and 2005 walking in Ida streets and not seeing many young folks in the streets because they were locked inside the prison. And as you know, Israel prison is not a normal prison. Prison everywhere is not normal,
right.
But the Israelis, how they did put their focus on this young generation, not only to arrest them that the war will continue around Ida camp. Now they arrested them and they had them pass through really severe physical and psychological torture and interrogations at the prison. And they really give them high sentences starting from 6 months to 3 years for participating in this type of demonstrations and resistance. And the sad part of this story that Israel did not leave this generation alone. So this generation started growing up in Ida camp, going to prison for 3 months, 6 months, 3 years, coming back from prison. They will arrest the same exact people again and again and again for the fourth, for the fifth times. And some of them have been in prison, are still in prison until these days. So when you think about it, you know, this generation really has spent almost half of their life inside the prison, facing really severe prison conditions inside and coming back to where they were born and raised, to either refugee camp, to a much worse situation. Now, Israel's plan is to really destroy the spirit, destroy this generation. What they did not realize, really, is that they're sending these young men to the same location, which is as miserable as it could be. There's no, you know, very crowded, lack of opportunities, not much jobs going on. The army presence is very heavy, surrounding by the wall from two sides.
And really cut off from their families, because I understand visitation rights, all those kinds of things.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But the problem is, now you're talking about this generation is about like mid-20s, and they don't have really a lot of many of them don't have higher education or, you know, baccalaureate degree. They don't have saving. And in our culture as Arab, you know, the man needs to have a lot of saving finished house to be able to marry and establish a family. So this generation lived with their families, and that's a problem, you know. And this led to other families of, you know, led to, you know, other young men and men from outside the camp to marry women from inside the camp. Because and leaving the camp with higher male presence than female presence, you know.
Yes.
So, putting all these elements together, what left for this generation?
Yeah.
And it led this led to and this the very interesting thing that I want to say here. This group of young men. When they came out of prison the first time, and the second time, and the third time, and the fourth time, did not stop resisting. Did not. They were badly hurt inside the prison. They had very frustrated from inside. Not much going on inside the camp for them. Amazingly enough, they still have this charisma, this motivation and resistance to occupation. Okay, and if you look at what's happening right now across the West Bank, either in the village, in the refugee camp, in the city, who's leading these demonstrations, who's leading these attacks, is the same generation that have been subjected to all these imprisonments throughout these years. So this is a result of a lot of oppression, a lot of imprisonments, a lot of lack of opportunities for this generation. And I don't know if it's good or bad, but I think it's good. The people who are leading or participating heavily in the current events across the West Bank and in Jerusalem, they really send a clear message to both the Palestinian Authority and to the political movements that what's happening is not led by you. What's happening has nothing to do with you. So they're really thirsty for another leadership, thirsty for a new face, a new agenda, a new vision or goals. Unfortunately, no one until now from the Palestinian Society is stepping in, either political movements or the PA or anyone stepping in and having clear agenda for what's happening or leading this spark to somewhere. And this is why you hear every day like 1 to 4 people will be shot and killed, a lot of demonstrations. But where are we going to, where this is heading toward, we really don't know.
Don't know. And the impact on Palestinian culture that a whole generation of men cannot participate in the culture as it, you know, as they understand it, in terms of, as you said, in terms of being able to buy homes or accumulate enough wealth to marry, to have a job, to have any normal life as they understand, you know, as they understand in the culture, the impact must be incredible in terms of family life. What's happening to this generation in terms of their vision of the future?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. And not only that, if you look at the population of the West Bank, and let's take the refugee camps, okay? Right now, you cannot extend the refugee camp. You know, the refugee camps are surrounded by small streets and cities and even walls in some locations. And Palestinians who live in the refugee camps, they cannot build any more floors on top of each other, because the first floor cannot handle any more floors.
Yeah.
Because when they built the camp in the past, you know, when they built the first floor and the foundation, they did not, it wasn't designed to carry 6 and 10 floors. So imagine now there's like 2 other generations coming in from the refugee camps, age 10 to age 14, going through the same exact experience. But thinking about the mid-20 right now generation who is still stuck with their parents, still stuck with the resistance and subjected to arrestment, with no future, no house, no independent life, so to speak, you know. At the same time, you cannot really build a space for them in the camp. At the same time, their families cannot really buy a property or a land outside of the camp because it's extremely expensive. One second, there's not much land left. So imagine this situation continues for the next, I don't want to say 10 years or more, for the next 4 or 5 years. It's going to be really a big explosion. Toward what? Against who? Against a bigger explosion against the occupation or against the Palestinian Authority, against the UNRWA, against who? I really don't know.
Because there's this sort of spirit of, what do we have to lose? I mean, you see what's going on with young Palestinians attacking Israelis. These are suicide missions. I mean, and what does it take to do that? It takes, what else is there for me to do? I need to resist. I have no future, and it leads to this despair and to this pushback.
That's another excellent point. Palestinians for the last couple of years has been yelling and screaming for everyone, for the United Nations, for the PLO, for the international community, for the PA. Things are really getting so hard for us. Palestinian state is very close to lose the hope. And if Palestinians lost the hope, that's really a big problem. They did not lose it yet. Yes, young men and even young women and young generation is really, very, very frustrated. There's not much going on for them. But without finding a mechanism right now, a mechanism to empower the community, to empower this generation, I think it's going to lead to even more explosions and more and more bigger thinking among these people.
Because it certainly will, and Israel doesn't see this. I mean, the Israel right is building this bomb, really. I mean, the response always is a military response. It's always the same response, and there's no creative answer to trying to deal with this explosion that's occurring, and it's going to get much worse.
Yeah, if you noticed since last October, if you noticed about the actions that the Palestinian state have been, against either settlers or Israeli soldiers or at the checkpoints or in Jerusalem, basically either stabbing or with cars or like. So Palestinians until this moment they did not really start doing big actions, and until now they're really they will think about the consequences, of course. They will know that Israel reaction will be airstrikes and invasions like 2002 tide, but they're very close to do anything. And slowly what I have been noticing, the conversation in the Palestinian street, that is, why do we always care about the Western view of us? I mean, we're exhausted. We're really tired of being careful, our way of resisting the occupation, of worrying about, they will call us terrorists, they will call us savages, they will call us violence, they will call us this and that, And they paid a lot of attention to that, but the international community, more and more the politicians, they really didn't pay attention to the Palestinian response in the resistance. If you notice, let's say from 2005 or 6 until until 2005 or 2004, there was not much really attacks from the Palestinian side. They're not like bombings inside Israel or blowing this or that, and nothing happened. Israel continued. The settlements continued everything, violating every single thing in the Palestinian lives. Palestinians live on only 11% of the land. This 11% is not really one unit. They killed the two-state solutions. It's really not worth talking about the two-state solutions geographically and demographically. It won't work. It would be naive to think that Israel will just withdraw settlements and move this wall. And it's not going to happen. So, with all of this trying, with Israel, with all of this, you have right-wing government, but also you have the failure of the Palestinian Authority with its political leadership. So what's left of the Palestinians?
Yeah.
You know?
The Zionist vision always has been to take the land, and since Oslo, the so-called peace process, all that's done is give Israel the time to do what it knows it has to do, and that's take the land, take the land. They just, you know, and the international community sits and wrings its hands, and why don't we have a peace process? Well, Israel's getting what it wants.
That's true.
It's taking the land. It's taking the land. But it is not calculating, as we've talked about, the explosion that's within. When you have all of these people here, and what are you going to do? What are you going to do about that? And they're just not factoring that in. They think that repression and military might, et cetera, will contain it. And anyone looking at history knows that doesn't work.
That doesn't work. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, okay. Tell us about Lodgy, the community center in the middle of this incredible Ida refugee camp, and the work it tries to do with this generation of kids and this population.
Well, the idea of Lodgy came from a group of men and women in 2001. This group of men and women who have a long history in the political activities and activism and even the resistance of the Palestinian Intifada. They came together around the time 2000-2001 saying that we really need to have a safe place, a ground for the kids and youth to meet and talk, because Ida Camp was a war zone. A war zone meaning Apaches and airstrikes and tanks and invasions and killing and bombing the houses was really, really a real war zone. And I remember in the past, the idea came, was like, okay, we need a space to bring the kids, to bring the children, to just protect them from getting lost with this mess. Okay, and it was a simple idea. We did not have location, physical location. We did not have space. We used to work in people's houses, in the schools, in the streets, up until around the 10th, 2003, we rented a small place in Ida refugee camp, two garages, actually.
So you were in the beginning of this?
Yeah. We rented these two small places in the middle of the camp, and we start running art activities, other activities with the kids and youth to come and feel like somebody's paying attention to us. And then the idea become really much bigger, and the interest from both the kids and youth and their families in having a good, not politicized place for the kids, growing. So we decided to really move out, not outside of the camp, just move out of this small location and build a new location. Now this location where Lodgy is now, yes, they cover the art section, the media, they cover the environment section in terms of rooftop gardens and water and other activities. Now, Lodgy Center is an umbrella for 12 different refugee camps, which responsible for running projects in 12 different refugee camps in across the West Bank, with college students and youth activities, actually. But why? Why are we doing that? Why Lodgy is doing that, actually? One main thing among this really hard and tough situation is to empower the people, to empower this generation, to educate this generation to reach to the point where they can really decide and choose by themselves. What do they want to do? What they want to become. As we know, it's heavily politicized, the West Bank. These youth and young generations got involved in so many things, either political activities and non-political activities. Focus on giving them the opportunity to learn about not only their history, but about their identity and memory. a lot of work that we do at LEGI and the folks they do at LEGI is to focus on the history of the conflict and the Palestinian society. For example, I ran a workshop with the 73 college students from 12 different refugee camps for 4 months on the theme of identity and memory. So that before you want to get involved in anything, you need to know who you are. What is your identity? Mm-hmm. You're a Palestinian, you're an Arab, you're in the Middle East. Right. But you have a forced identity that was forced on you being refugees. This was not your choice. What do you do with it? The history, not only what happened, but how did it happen? Who's responsible? So you need to know all these facts as a young. Before you jump, growing up, knowing these facts, it will help this generation. Not figuring out even what to do, like a clear idea of where to go, because it's very easy for any Palestinian, based on the current situation, to get involved with resistance, get involved with political activities, etc.
The traditional family and the traditional culture has been so interrupted that the kinds of things that were handed down through family and through marriages and the whole thing is totally interrupted.
That's a good point. I was going to talk about it after this. I mean, look, take Ada refugee camp. Ada refugee camp has around actually more than 5,000 people because we shouldn't trust any statistics of the UNRWA. That's on their website.
Yeah, right.
Never been updated. They didn't do the research. They don't update their numbers or anything. Half of this population is under the age of 18. It's a pretty crowded place.
Oh,
practically, you can cross half of the camp without walking in the street, from a rooftop to a rooftop to a rooftop.
Yeah.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And families are very important, socially and politically, actually, not only socially, social aspects. Very, very important. But the family, the Palestinian family who lives in the refugee camp is pretty exhausted.
Okay.
Very exhausted. For example, the father, all what he thinks about is looking for a job, which is not my job, not there. To secure at least not I don't want to say, okay, secure food, secure other resources for the family. They have schools. They finish high school. Where do they go? You know,
the schools where are they? Mostly the UNRWA schools.
But there's like a very bad UNRWA school system in Attica, especially the boys' school. Extremely horrible. You know, but they manage to finish mid school and they go to high school and they finish high school. College is very expensive there. To the Palestinian standards, it's very expensive. What do you do? And for Palestinians that I have been noticing, college is very important. And if you look at the generation of Palestinians, they always finish their bachelor degree and master degree when they're like 35 or 40 years old. Why? Because there are really many, many folks who finish high school. Their families don't have the money. You don't have the money to send them to college because if you have 3 children or 5 children, the first child will go to college next year or next 2 years, the second child will go to college. Sometimes you end up with 3 children in college. And who can provide expenses?
Yeah.
Cannot. So one or two of these folks needs to step out of college or don't go at all, go work, okay, until one or two finish college, and then you come back. And usually that happens, you know, much, much later. I finished my bachelor degree in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I finished high school in the...
How old were you at that point?
Up there, I was like 32. I don't know.
Mm.
But yeah, you know, my friends, my brothers, my sister finished her master degree and when she had 4 children... Okay, and her husband was in prison, and she finished her master degree. You know, there's this passion about finishing education. People love to finish their education. Okay, they love to finish college. They love to continue. And
even
love
though at the end of that,
there's no jobs, there's nothing, there's no opportunities. But there's something. It is as if like this is my right. I need to get it. I don't care about putting the degree in the drawer or not doing or go work in the constructions or sanitation or something, but I need to get it. It's about like this right is somebody is trying to prevent me from this right or taking it from me. I need to get it. So it's practically okay, yeah. Knowledge is beautiful, and everybody should get it. But also, you know, I need to get this because there's somebody who's trying to take it from me.
Right.
You know, this sense.
It is a part of the Palestinian culture that really still remains strong, and that is this passion for education.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen statistics lately, but I remember looking at one point where the percentage of Palestinians with college degrees and advanced degrees put against even Israel
is very high.
It's very high. It's incredibly high.
It's very high. It's very high because Palestinians, an older generation, like my brother who came out of prison, he spent 29 years in prison. Okay, he came out of prison 2 years ago. After 2 years, he's at college now. He finished a year and a half, and he's 50 years old.
Mm.
Even though he doesn't need a college degree.
Right.
Sometimes the doctors in the college, they will ask him to lecture because he spent 29 years in prison reading.
Where is he studying?
At the university in Bethlehem.
Uh-huh.
He spent really 29 years reading and teaching in prison. So he's a very well educated, brilliant man. But yet, he's going to college with young folks. He wants a degree. Why he doesn't want it? Why does he want it? I really don't know personally. But he just
matter of pride.
This
is what I need to do.
Yeah,
terrific. Let's talk about water a minute, and particularly, let's start with how Israel uses water as a weapon. I mean, water is scarce in Israel-Palestine to begin with. Much of the water really comes from Palestinian aquifers. Israel takes the water and sells it back to the Palestinians at four times the price it sells to Israelis. They come into the camps, they shoot the water towers very often up above the houses.
The water tanks.
Which they need because the water comes in frequently. They turn on so people have to fill their tanks when they get. Anyway, let's talk about water and...
But water is politics there.
Yeah.
Okay, and it is due a lot to the division of the West Bank area A, B, and C, and is due a lot about the path of the wall and the settlements buildings. For example, Area C, as we know, is around 60 to 63% of the West Bank.
Yeah.
Okay? And is fully controlled by Israel. Geographically, much of the aquifers, the good aquifers, are located in Area C. Okay? Geographically, when the rain falls and the flood water, water goes underground to Area C. It's like as a slope. Underground to go to these aquifers. So Israel takes around 70. This is based. If you Google, go to Google and type water in Israel Palestine. It's amazing. You get everybody agrees that Israel takes around 73 to 75% of the total water. The World Bank, the United Nations, Amnesty, even Israeli human rights organizations agree on. Even NPR here in Boston, CNN, New York Times, everybody agree that Israel really takes over 70% of the total water in the West Bank, which is Palestinian water, and gives back the rest to the Palestinians. Yet, they take 10% of that 27% and give it to Israeli settlements. So when you think about it, it's less than 20% is left for Palestinians. And this is why, especially in the summer season, water is a major crisis in the West Bank, especially in refugee camps, in even in cities, you know, within Area A, you know, because Palestinian areas in Area C, they're like more to get water because they're hooked with the same pipe as the settlements, you know. But in Area A especially, but you know, Area C is also facing a lot of problems with like the known that Palestinians will not be allowed to dig wells or harvest rainwater or build cisterns even. It would be really destroyed because as Palestinians who live in Area C, You want to build a system to harvest the rainwater from your rooftop.
Right.
You need to get the permits from the civil administration in the army, in the Israeli army. You know, you go and you need to get a permit to build. And it's like, just like a dream to get a permit. And if you build it without a permit, obviously it will be destroyed.
Well, that's why I use the word Israel uses water as a weapon, because who can be against cisterns? Who can be against collecting water that's you know, unless you want to use it as a weapon, unless you want to...
No, especially in Area C.
Yeah.
Why do they do that, especially in the Jordan Valley? If you want to deprive or move one group of people outside of place, especially like people who really rely on some natural resource, you just take this natural resource from them or restrict it, and they would be forced to leave. And this is the goal in Area C, using water as a weapon to displace and move people out of this Area C to Area B or Area A, because you have farmers, you have people who have animals, and you just, you know, you need water for your daily life, practically, in these areas. But the problem is not that different. There is a problem in Area A. And in Ida Camp, I remember in 2011, I think. 2011, I was with my wife and my daughter. My daughter was like 6 months old.
Mm-hmm.
And Ida Camp did not have water for around 73 days. And it was hot summer. Mm-hmm. Which I had with my wife to climb from a rooftop to a rooftop to a rooftop with a hose, with a pipe and a hose, you know, to borrow water from the neighbors, to put in our tanks. No, to borrow water from my sister's house, which is like five houses away. So I started jumping from a rooftop to a rooftop to a rooftop with the hose, and hook it with a small motor to pump water from her tanks to our water tanks that our 6 months daughter can take a very simple, modest shower.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the rest of the supplies is like everyone in the camp, you need to carry gallons and bottles and go to this small faucet sink, you know, and fill them with water from near Lagi Center and bring it to use it for the toilet, to use it for the dishes. Not much cleaning of the house, not much doing laundries, even, you know, showers is a major thing, and cooking and everything.
Yeah.
So imagine you live next to a settlement, ghetto settlements. You go to one of the rooftops with a good binocular, you can see a swimming pool, gardens, green lands, and you know that this is your water.
Yeah.
You look at the camp full of water tanks on the rooftops, full, empty, the pipes are rusted because the water is not running inside these pipes, and you really just, you know, wish to take a 5 minute shower or less.
Yeah.
So. Yes, in some areas it's a weapon to move people out. In other areas, it's just oppression and keep humiliating people and treating them like non-human.
Yeah. In the hope that they'll somehow leave.
Yeah, well, I don't think they will leave, because if you want to ask people in a refugee camp to leave, they would leave to where?
Where?
It's like, yeah, in Area C and B, yes. But in the West Bank, you know, in Area A especially, where would they leave? I mean, yeah, it's just like, how can we make your life miserable? More and more and more every day. That's it.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
I mean, listen, from a Palestinian perspective, this is an occupation. What do I expect from an occupation? To treat me with flowers? It's occupation. So occupation, meaning oppression, meaning bad treatments, meaning taking rights, this and that. You know, this is my expectation from the, my response to these actions, the people, the international communities, everyone should be really different, okay? Because especially here in the U.S., when you think about the U.S., the United States, and the American societies, it's very deeply invested in what's happening in Ida Camp and other areas. Tons of tear gas will be thrown in people's houses, homes, and rooftops every single day. And these tear gas is stamped with "Made in USA." The M16s and the rifles that the soldiers carry and walk in the streets of Aydekem and shoot at people, stamped with made in USA. The Apaches and the helicopters they use, it's made in USA. So the Palestinians' perceptions of the USA is everywhere. Okay. and this is your, we're in the tax season. Soon everybody's going to be paying a lot of taxes. Big chunk of this tax is going to go
for this.
For this.
Yeah, it brings us back to the question we asked earlier, to
what's in Israel's head? I mean, what, we can't answer this question, but so you're making people's lives miserable. You're turning the screw, you know. You got your boot on their throat. What's the end game? What's the end game for Israel?
I don't know. I think when I think of Israel, I think about old colonized powers also, you know. Would they use the same ideology is to victimize themselves and criminalize the victims. Okay? Not I think of myself as a victim, because if I think of the Palestinians people as victims, some type of a weakness here. But they always victimize themselves. And who buys it? The West.
Yeah.
Who buys it and believes it and adapts it? The West. Without really looking, you know, 2 degrees to the right or 2 degrees to the left, and they will know the truth. But they always buy this story, you know, but the facts on the grounds are absolutely different. So in their hands, a lot of support from the major powers of the world in their hands, you know, weak, full of chaos Arab regime around them, but more the support of the West, especially the United States.
Yeah. Now, we talked about water, the issue of water, water as a weapon. Lodgy Camp and the work that you're doing with One for Three is trying to address this in some way. Talk about One for Three and talk about what's happening in Lodgy Camp in terms of trying to deal with the water issue.
Well, first, there's no solution for the water issue except dealing with occupation and figure out a solution for the occupation. So the solution needs to become from the political level. Okay, the international community needs to interfere, the UN needs to interfere, everybody needs to jump in to solve this problem. What do we do as 143.org with our partners at LAGI and other wonderful partners like the graduate students and professors from Tufts universities, graduate students and professors from Harvard also joining us in this effort, is to think about project that could be owned by the community to alleviate the crisis, empower the people, and keep them going with whatever they want to do. So basically what we did 3 years ago, we did not go with our plans from here and ideas and force them in the community. So we said, this is going everywhere in Palestine and we should really not do that, because people are smart, capable, and skilled to do these things, but they need the resources. Okay? So when we went, we met with the community, men, women, youth, even children. And we asked him, okay, what exactly going on here? How can we help? What can we do to support you? And the two major issues there, water and health. You know, Aydekem doesn't have a clinic. You know, water and health. And we said, okay, if we need to think about anything, it has to come from you. The idea needs to come from the community, and the community needs to be involved every step of the way. And they have to own it and sustain it. So we start thinking together, us here with them, thinking about, you know, ways of improving the water quality and a little bit the quantity in the camp, because the lack of water has been causing a lot of problems, especially among children in terms of diarrhea, fever, and all these things. Because the tanks, when you leave the tank and the pipes empty from water for over 2 months, they get rusted, bacteria grow, etc., etc. So we asked Tufts Engineering School to join, and amazingly enough, they have been with us for the past 3 years, and actually we're going again in March to start a new location in Al-Walaja village next to Bethlehem, a new water testing program there. And we start like doing water testing, taking samples of water from every single water tank faucet in the camp and families, and have big records for the past 3 years. So we have data for the past 3 years about the quality of water. And we found a lot of contamination that due to the lack of water. And the second thing we did, education pocket of how to clean the water if you find contaminated water. Some cases we had to change the water tanks, very old, very rusted water tanks, change them with the new water tanks.
But they, are the new water tanks plastic?
The old are metal. And this new, actually a factory in Hebron, a Palestinian factory in Hebron, designed these new water tanks. White plastic layer from inside and black layer from inside and white from outside. It won't absorb a lot of sun, the white, not like the plants.
You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
From JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters by James W. Douglas. Douglas got El Fetchatavi to create a network of subordinate focal point offices in the armed services and then throughout the entire U.S. government. Each office that Travi set up was put under a cleared, unquote, CIA employee. That person took orders directly from the CIA but functioned under the cover of his particular office and branch of government. Such, quote, reading, unquote, Prati said decades later in an interview, resulted in a web of covert CIA operatives in the State Department, in the FAA, in the Customs Service, in the Treasury, in the FBI, and all around through the government up to and in the White House. Then we began to assign people there who those agencies thought were from the Defense Department, but they actually were people that we put there from the CIA. The consequence in the early 1960s when Kennedy became president was that the CIA had placed a secret team of its own employees throughout the entire U.S. government. It was accountable to no one except the CIA, headed by Alan Dulles. After Dulles was fired by Kennedy, the CIA's deputy director of plans, Richard Helms, became this invisible government's immediate commander. No one except a tight inner circle of the CIA even knew of the existence of this top-secret intelligence network, much less the identity of its deep-cover bureaucrats. These CIA focal points, unquote, as Dulles called them, constituted a powerful, unseen government within the government. Its Dulles-appointed members would act quickly, with total obedience when called on by the CIA to assist its covert operations. Part of the upshot of that, of course, is that ultimately the CIA began operating domestically and instituting or playing a primary role in coups d'etat here as they had abroad, President Kennedy's murder being just one of those coups.
Take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest.
You're listening to episode 740 of Unwelcome Guests, the words and deeds of the U.S. Deep State. I'm Robin Upton. We've just heard a reading by Dave Emery, whom we're going to hear in our second hour. But before we do, this is a 1993 recording of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty storytelling, first about JFK and the Bay of Pigs, and secondly about JFK's Vietnam policy. He's referenced in our second hour, but is new to the show, although he does have a WikiSpooks page if you'd like to look him up, and he's also on Wikipedia for a more comprehensive but commercially controlled media take on his revelations.
We're here today on August 5th, 1993, with Colonel Al Fletcher Prouty, Air Force retired, to discuss various incidents in history that were so formative in post-World War II U.S. history, politics, power, and to look at things in more detail than is commonly done throughout the media in this day and age. One thing that I've always felt you provide a great deal of solid information on that is never discussed is the whole formative event of the Kennedy administration, which is the Bay of Pigs. And citing the letter to the president that was written by the four people that he convened to study what went wrong with the Bay of Pigs, there's a great deal in that committee, the testimony that they heard from people, the way they operated, that is never talked about, that is crucial, it seems, to understanding how Kennedy got his sea legs, so to speak, when he became president, in seeing how things weren't working right with the failure of this operation. Mm-hmm. I'd like to have you tell us some about, perhaps start with this final report that was never found for years because people were asking the wrong questions, that indicates the perceptiveness of the president in trying to understand what had really happened so that it wouldn't happen again.
You know, it's an awfully good approach to the problem because very few people have studied the Kennedy period before his death or even have known much about Kennedy before he was elected president. You know, he came right out of World War II with a busy career during the war as a naval officer. He was elected a congressman from Massachusetts, served as a congressman. He stayed here in Washington, served as a senator from Massachusetts, and then was elected president. There are very few men arriving at the office of president who have more background in Washington than Kennedy had. He was younger than most of them, but he had more background experience, which means he knew the bad things as well as the good things. There were a lot of things that he was against in the way the government had been going under the Eisenhower and post-war administration, and he wanted to use the presidential power to change them. And one of the first things that he found that he had to take care of, there were two things, was the Bay of Pigs. Now, that was an Eisenhower program. That was approved by the Eisenhower National Security Council in March of 1960. About May of 1960, the CIA people came to my office because it was my job in the Pentagon to provide the support of CIA's clandestine operations. That was my job. I had been in the job for years. And they wanted to have the military open a base where they could train these exiled Cubans who were perfectly willing to try to get back into Cuba and incite enough rebellion to throw Castro out, because that's what the original Eisenhower approval was, to try to get proven Cuban support for the plan. Eisenhower would never have approved an invasion. He never did. Eisenhower knew too much about invasions to have that happen. Well, you follow that through now from the mid-60s, and then you have this important event when Kennedy and Nixon had the TV debates just before the election. And everybody felt that the two were just inseparable. There was no way to tell who was going to be elected president. And they came to debate number four, and Kennedy pressed the Cuban issue, the Castro issue, because Nixon had made so much of it, you know, that the government, we would overthrow Castro, got to get rid of Castro, he's a communist and all that sort of thing. And Kennedy, who knew as much or more about the program than even Nixon did, whipped Nixon in the debate. And let me tell you just a little personal incident as a part of my official duties, but it lets you see the validity of this. I was asked to go to the Senate office building to a certain room number and to pick up four men and bring them back to the office of the Secretary of Defense. That's where I was working. I was working with the Office of Secretary of Defense. The four men I picked up were the leaders of the Cuban program, Artima and Mendonca and De Verona and those people. And they knew Kennedy. They were in the number, the office room I was sent to was Kennedy's office. So here's Kennedy with these Cubans talking with them in August of 1960. He had just been won the Democratic nomination to run for president. He knew this background. And furthermore, I understand that the Cubans had visited him in his home in Palm Beach. He knew these people. He knew everything that was going on. Well, Nixon didn't know he knew that. So in the debate, when it came time to argue with Nixon about it, Kennedy cleaned up on that debate, and a lot of people believe that's how he won the election, a very narrow election, but he won. Days after that debate, the CIA came to us in the Pentagon talking about an invasion of Cuba. That was not the approved plan. Kennedy was not president yet. We knew Eisenhower wouldn't talk about that. The CIA did it. They put pressure on Kennedy themselves. And what had been a plan to drop 30 men groups from an airplane, a C-46 can carry about 30 with their equipment, or over the beach program from submarines or fast boats, 20 or 30 men, all of a sudden they're talking about 3,000 men, training the 3,000. I had to send men to Guatemala to train pilots. I had to get aircraft reconfigured in Arizona so to be used for that purpose. We got Filipino experienced men that General Lansdale knew that had helped him during the time when he was in the overthrow of Quirino in the Philippines, which is much like the Castro thing. So the Filipino experience was valuable. People don't realize how big the Cuban program was. The ships had arms and equipment on board enough for 25,000 fighters. Not just the 1,500 that went on the beach. You see, all of this developed in the working arrangements that were being made from day to day to support this operation. But the strange thing was how it accelerated right after the election. Mm-hmm. They were going to press Kennedy to accept the invasion because during the time before his inaugural, they got all of this change started and in being. So that by the time of the invasion, actually, the ships were at sea from different areas already heading for Cuba, and Kennedy had not approved the program. So, you see, that is so different from what most people have heard about the way the thing was organized. One thing that the agency had done at the suggestion of the JCS was to bring in a most competent Marine colonel who knew invasion tactics to work out the invasion plan. The JCS had told the CIA that if Castro's combat aircraft were not destroyed before the men hit the beach, there was no chance that they could get on because the combat aircraft were being on home ground and all, and the men just on the beach with no protection couldn't protect themselves. They must destroy the aircraft totally before the men hit the beach. That was a fundament of the whole plan. The Marine colonel knew it, and the JCS had told the CIA that. Well, it finally came down to where, after several meetings with the president, during which he would not approve the program, finally, in the middle of April of 1961, Mr. Dulles told him that, well, we have got to do something. We've been training these men now for a year. They think they're going to be brought into their home, and they think we're going to help them gain their country back again. And, incidentally, the ships with the men on board are at sea, rendezvousing around the Vieques Island area. We must get an approval to go. Is there anything else to keep it from going? Kennedy waited for the strike on the airfields of Cuba until Saturday morning. They destroyed 7 of Castro's 10 combat-capable aircraft. They didn't have to bother with the transports and all. They went after the bombers and the fighters. They destroyed 7 of them. Unfortunately, 3 jets had taken off from where they had been the day before when we had pictures of them and gone down to Santiago for the weekend, and they weren't there and they weren't destroyed. So on Sunday, when they went to brief the president, they told him, they showed him pictures. They had destroyed 7 planes, but 3 were left. They had to get those 3 airplanes before the men hit the beach at Zapata Landing. Well, Kennedy ordered specifically, it was about sometime about mid-afternoon, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he ordered the first thing to be the destruction of those aircraft. That was a Kennedy order. A very close friend of mine was in command of the bomber base in Puerto Cabezas, Nicaragua, that was to do the job. 4 B-26s were to be dispatched about 1 o'clock, and it's very important because they had to hit the planes before the dawn landing of the men on the beach, or the landing would they'd be in the air supporting the beach, and they were so superior to the bombers that they'd shoot the bombers down one after the other. Everybody understood that, we thought. So Kennedy ordered that, and as a prerequisite to the landing. He agreed to the landing on Monday morning, April 18th, 1961. Now, when there was a study of what happened, Kennedy put together the Cuban study group to find out what went wrong. Here is an old mimeograph copy from my days in the Pentagon of the report of this study group. It wasn't seen by anyone, or very few people, for at least 20 years when it began to pop up in books that people knew about it. And then finally, in 1981, this book was published for academic purposes, for university use, a book called Zapata, which is every word that's in here, just an absolute copy of this. But this is the old original. I want you to see what it looked like in the beginning. And when the Cuban study group questioned the people that came before it as to what happened and why didn't we succeed with the Bay of Pigs program, they ran into a most interesting situation because, first of all, Kennedy and his advisors were very adept at this organization. They really did a good job. Can you imagine a committee better than this one to study the Bay of Pigs? Alan Dulles was on that study group. Admiral Burke was on a study group. Admiral Burke was a CNO of the Navy, member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he was the one who had been designated to support the operation of the Bay of Pigs landings. Now, he knew more about it than anybody else. He was sitting in the room, no matter who came in, Admiral Burke, old Arleigh Burke, knew what was going on. And I've talked to him many times since then about this, and he did know. Another man was General Maxwell Taylor. Maxwell Taylor and Kennedy had never met. But Kennedy knew Maxwell Taylor's reputation, and he knew that he was a good, solid man for this kind of investigation. So he put Maxwell Taylor as the chairman of the group. But there was a fourth man, and as my friends would tell me when they'd come back from the hearing, I knew almost all the guys that went in there. My office was only about 2 doors down from where the committee was meeting in the Pentagon. They'd come back and they'd say, you know, those 3 guys are pretty tough. But it's that little son of a gun on that straight back chair in the corner that's really watching it with his beady eye. Doesn't say anything. Well, that's Bobby Kennedy. Can you imagine? Bobby Kennedy, Maxwell Taylor, Arleigh Burke, and Alan Dulles to study what went wrong with the Bay of Pigs. Now, they were even sharper than that because by that time, Maxwell Taylor and my boss, General Lemnitzer, and Arleigh Burke had made up their mind that this was the last time that the CIA was going to get into a major operation. They weren't the right people to be running military-type operations. So they brought in other competent people to provide them with information that they would provide to Kennedy in this report. And one of the best things they did, one of the people they brought in that was really important, was General Walter Beadle Smith. Now, people who remember World War II will remember that he was the chief of staff for Eisenhower for the invasion of Europe and the whole European operation of World War II. A very competent, experienced, reliable general. And immediately at the end of World War II, Walter Beadle Smith had been sent to Moscow as the American ambassador to the Soviet Union. Well, of course, they were our partners through the war. It was a very friendly relationship. Smith was highly regarded by the Soviets as a general that had helped them defeat Hitler and his German troops. So it was a great assignment for Smith. He learned a hell of a lot from that. And so what did he do? From Moscow, he was assigned to the new Central Intelligence Agency. And he became the director of Central Intelligence. A lot of people don't remember that.
Under Truman.
Under Truman, yes. And as the director of Central Intelligence, all the CIA people knew him very well. They knew that he knew things, they knew he was tough, and that they couldn't get around him. So what did they do in the Zapata program? They bring General Smith in. He didn't have anything to do with the Cuban program, but he was pretty useful. Because, among other things, and this probably tips Kennedy's hand as close as anything I can think of in trying to study what happened. Why was Kennedy killed? What brought up the pressures and the power and the intense feelings against Kennedy that would cause people in power to make the decision to get rid of him? But it begins with this sort of a thing. In response to questions about running something like the Bay of Pigs, Smith said clearly, a democracy cannot wage war. When you go to war, you pass a law giving extraordinary powers to the president. The people of our country assume, when the emergency is over, that the rights and the powers that were temporarily delegated to the chief executive will be returned to the states, to the counties, to the people. Pretty fundamental statement from a major, not I mean a full general, but from a major general, an important man.
Right.
He went on to say now about Bay of Pigs, I only know what the papers say, but covert operations, and he knew a lot about them, he'd been the DCI, can be done up to a certain size.
Right.
And we've handled some pretty large operations. By that he meant, if it's only not more than two or three people, it can't be a secret anymore. In fact, the New York Times had carried front page headlines saying the U.S. government was supporting the exiles against Castro in March of 1961. It was already all over the papers. He's pointing out that out as a mistake. But then Smith begins to get to the point. He said, I think that so much publicity has been given to CIA that the covert work might have to be put under another roof. He was pretty explicit about that. He'd say, it's time we take the bucket of slop and go out and cover over it. Well, what something like that does is put in the president's mind the words from a man that knew everything there was, and from the time he heard that from Walter Beadle Smith, by way of his Cuban study group committee, you know he had one thing in his mind. He's going to get through with the CIA in that kind of business. And let me just read you what General Taylor presented to the general when that was over. When the Cuban study group had completed its work,
right. They
had agreed unanimously with their own report. Even though Dulles was on there, it was a unanimous vote. Even though Bobby Kennedy was on it, it was a unanimous vote. It ended up as a letter to the president on the 13th of June, 1961. Their work was done very quickly. And one of the dominant things to come out of it was a paper that President Kennedy signed personally and sent directly to General Lemnitzer, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He didn't send it to the State Department, to Dean Rusk. He didn't even send it to McNamara, which all correspondents ordinarily would go through, and he didn't send a copy to CIA. So you can see that Kennedy was saying to General Lemnitzer, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, this is what I want done. Now, in the procedures of how you do these things in the Joint Staff, where everything is very formal, it just happened that I was the officer that the director of the Joint Staff gave this paper to from the White House and said, prepare a briefing for the chiefs. And I did, so I'm very familiar with it. And just, I'll only read a paragraph, but you don't have to read more. The president informed the Joint Chiefs of Staff that the president regards the Joint Chiefs of Staff as his principal military advisor, responsible both for initiating advice to him and responding to a request for advice. He expects their advice to come to him direct and unfiltered, and that the Joint Chiefs of Staff have a similar responsibility for the defense of the nation in a Cold War as they have in conventional hostilities. Now, in the terminology of the government, to say that the Joint Chiefs of Staff have that responsibility in the Cold War, he's saying the CIA will no longer have that responsibility. You see, that was a stroke of the pen that was as powerful as a thunderclap. And when I read that to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you could have heard a pin drop. And I was told, Colonel Prouty, take that back to the files. When we need it, we'll call you. You know what that meant? They were going to wait until the situation had been completely prepared for this next step forward, because that's a major change.
They understood the implications.
Yes. They realized, how can the military in uniform go into covert operations? I mean, the ridiculous POW MIA situation that we have now is a result of that. 15 years of the Vietnam War, everybody that went to Vietnam was under the command, operational control of a CIA man. Well, then how can he be a prisoner of war? He's a spy. And that's what the enemy thought. They didn't give a darn about all the fine print.
Right.
So you see, the chiefs of staff knew that. So for the next few years, Kennedy studied this situation and prepared the ground for a report. But this is why I feel that the key, the beginning point in the troubles that Kennedy had with many points of power began with this situation, because he signaled clearly, with the assistance of General Smith and the others, that he was putting the CIA out of the business and turning them back to intelligence only. And, of course, the law that created CIA never gave him this authority in the first place. So he was right, and he knew that law. That's why I say the Bay of Pigs is the key to the problems that came later.
One other thing in that is the question of the miscommunications, apparently, that occurred come Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening, that seems to have centered around McGeorge Bundy, his
yes,
special assistant.
There is a common misunderstanding about that business. Among the people called before this Cuban study group, the four men that I mentioned to you, was the advisor to the president, Mr. McGeorge Bundy. And he, I believe, visited them three times, and they also accepted written material from him. It was a pretty thorough contact between the committee and Mr. Bundy. And then in their conclusions, which anybody can read, they pointed out that it was their opinion that the most significant reason for the failure of the Bay of Pigs was the fact that this airstrike that Kennedy had ordered on that Sunday afternoon, the day before the landing, was canceled. And in pursuing how that happened, they found out that at 9:30 on Sunday night, McGeorge Bundy had called General Cabell, who was responsible for the CIA at that time, because of all weekends, Allen Dulles was out of the country. Here he's in charge of the whole thing, and Allen Dulles is out of the country. But anyway, General Cabell, perfectly competent person, was called by McGeorge Bundy and told not to fly the airplanes that night until they could operate them the next day off the beach at the Zapata landing site, which destroyed the whole operation. If McGeorge Bundy had had a little more military experience, perhaps, or if General Cabell had had just a little more, thought about it more, they'd have realized that they absolutely destroyed the Bay of Pigs there, because if they didn't destroy those last three aircraft, they were going to lose. And those three aircraft, the first thing in the morning, sank the two supply ships, so that the men on the beach had no ammunition, their food was gone, their radios were gone, their trucks were gone, everything. Just those little airplanes did it. And during the period that the men were on the beach, they destroyed 16 B-26s. In other words, just raised havoc with the whole operation. So it's obvious the study group when Maxwell Taylor wrote his letter to the president, he said, our conclusion is that the principal reason for the failure was the failure to carry out the mission that president had ordered to destroy those last three planes.
Why did Bundy give that call?
There have been a lot of collateral points. The paper I've read to you does not elaborate on why he did it. But with Bobby Kennedy in the room, you know very well that Bundy couldn't say such other things as, oh, the president told me to do it, because right. Bobby would have known that wasn't true.
Right.
So he couldn't say that. And perhaps Bundy's inexperience in military matters, I don't know. I couldn't make an excuse. All I know is he called Cabell and said, don't fly it. And that's on the record. I don't say that. I read it from the record.
Because there's that other place that we put the yellow Post-it in there that was the actual base conclusion of their sense of why it had failed, which is never talked about. This is never articulated anywhere in newspapers or anything if the Bay of Pigs is ever discussed.
Yeah. You know, that's a problem, too, because there are many books written about the Bay of Pigs. And some of them were written after 1981 when Zapata had been released. Up to that time, this kind of thing was not available. I had it, but I don't know anybody else had it. But so that they have never quoted the exact words. And to be sure that we understand exactly what the study group found, I will read you the words that they sent to the president. It's item 43 in their report, and it simply says, at about 9:30 p.m., on 16 April, that was that Sunday when Kennedy directed the attack, Mr. McGeorge Bundy, special assistant to the president, telephoned General C.P. Cabell, who was the deputy director of CIA and had a long-time experience with CIA, to inform him that the Dawn airstrikes the following morning should not be launched until they could be conducted from a strip within the beachhead. Now, you see, there was a strip within the beachhead, but you can't destroy the airplanes after they've already destroyed your landing. I mean, it's backwards.
Right.
And this hit the committee. I mean, this is the thing they said. This is our finding as the basic reason for the failure of the Bay of Pigs. And when they interviewed Cubans down through here in the back, when they talked to these poor Cubans that were involved, each of the Cubans, one after the other, says the problem was we didn't have the aircraft to destroy those last three.
Right.
And, of course, certain propagandists or whatever you want, revisionists, want to say that the problem was that Kennedy denied the air cover.
Right.
There was no air cover in the plan because the plan was written and approved by the JCS to destroy all of Castro's aircraft first.
Right.
You don't need air cover if they have no planes. See, the plan was built on that idea. And people say that he should have provided the air cover. There is a National Security Council directive, which is a superior document to everything we have in the Executive Department, that was produced and signed in Eisenhower's time in March of 1954. It'd been in effect for a long time, called NSC Directive Number 5412. And that directive prohibits the use of uniformed services in covert operations. Prohibits it. Our government knew that during Eisenhower's time, and of course Kennedy knew that during his time. That precluded the use of military in a clandestine operation. And that's the kind of thing that General Smith was referring to. You can't mix the two. You can't put the military in covert operations. And we're having trouble with that today. Is our operation in Somalia, is that considered maybe a covert operation, or is it a military operation? How are we running? Are the people that are flying the airplanes considered military, or are they considered some kind? We don't have a place in the middle of those. This is what the government's trying to work out at the present time. What is the role of the military? Even in the Vietnam War for 15 years, the military that were used before 1965, and you know it started in 1945, the first American was killed in Vietnam in September 45. For those 20 years, all activity was covert. It was under the CIA. So that's what we're going back to the program here. And Kennedy knew that it was against the government policy to use military active duty air crews in such a landing as a covert operation, because it immediately would reveal the hand of the U.S. government in an operation against a sovereign country, and that's not permitted. So the people that throw the idea of Kennedy's failure to provide air cover are just unaware of the situation that existed legally, in practice, and in the way you use military in this country. We agree with those laws and international agreements, and we don't do it the other way. You see, that's a good way to link the two together, because historically, these two things ran together. They were essentially the same thing. They were major CIA operations that the generals knew were too big to even be thought of as covert operations. You know, the CIA assisted a rebellion in Indonesia in 1958, in which at one time I myself ordered the delivery of 42,000 rifles. I mean, that's not a covert operation, you see. We were using submarines against the south coast of the islands of Indonesia, not a covert operation. So the military looked very carefully at these things and knew that the CIA was going much too far. We supported the Khamba people in Tibet, something like 60 or 70,000 of them, by dropping arms to them, medicine, weapons, everything. To those people, that's not covert, but we thought it was. You know, we put it under the rules of CIA's operation. And this is what Kennedy was facing during that transition from the Eisenhower time, when the CIA had begun to get into all these things, the Indonesian rebellion, the Tibetan program, the Cuban program, all were in that period of time, and Kennedy inherited that. And at the same time, General Ridgway, who died just a week or two ago, told Kennedy clearly, don't ever let Americans come into Asia. Don't ever bring American soldiers into Asia. And General Bradley, I used to be General Bradley's personal pilot, and I know the gentleman, one of the finest men ever put a uniform on. He gave Kennedy the same answers. Eisenhower, in this book here on the foreign relations of the United States, says how bitterly he opposes the entry of American divisions into Vietnam. If I've tabbed that page, it's very interesting. This, by the way, is the Foreign Relations of the United States, Vietnam, August to December 1963, zeroing right in on the peak of the time of Kennedy's involvement in the planning for the future in Vietnam. And anybody that wants to think that Kennedy was not deep into the activities in Vietnam doesn't realize that during this period of that time, there were meetings going on day after day after day in the White House, in which my own boss, General Victor Krulak, was involved, Maxwell Taylor was involved, McNamara was involved, and what that would mean is when they'd come back to the office, the rest of us and the joint staff were involved supporting the president in the development of these plans, because he knew that he was either going to have to make the decision, as he did in NSAM 55,
right,
to get the CIA out of this covert work, and with the CIA out of, say, the operation in Vietnam, he saw no role for the military. Huh. And it was perfectly logical from the Kennedy point of view and from what the Joint Chiefs of Staff had told him, that we should not be in Vietnam. And when he wrote this document, which, because of our movie JFK, Oliver Stone's work, where we introduced the subject of the National Security Action Memorandum number 263,
right,
which was written and signed on October 11th, 1963, saying that all U.S., all American personnel would be out of Vietnam by the end of 65. That was Kennedy's decision after all of this work spanning this period of 6 months And here you can read day by day by day the meetings were held. I counted over 50 meetings that are listed in this book in which my own boss, General Krulak, attending meetings with President Kennedy on Vietnam. And as Kennedy worked his Vietnam policy out during that period, he arrived at what you might call a scenario. He wanted to be sure everybody understood what he was doing. So he sent General Krulak quickly to Vietnam, the idea being published in the papers that he was going to get the last-minute word in Vietnam to see how things stood.
That was in late August, or?
Late August. I think he actually traveled in September, okay, because I myself was sent to the SINCVAC headquarters in Hawaii to meet with Admiral Felt. And I have yet never revealed the reasons for that meeting, but the two had a very strong... I was doing a lot of writing for General Krulak, and they were very much related. And when General Krulak came back, he met with Kennedy and discussed up-to-date the things he heard from the people out there, which, of course, we knew by telephone anyway, but it made the scenario more reasonable. And so immediately, Kennedy ordered Maxwell Taylor and McNamara to go to Vietnam. And so they went late in September, I believe it is. After a very busy flying trip, going all over the country, talking not only to President Diem, but to his opposition, because by that time, Diem had some serious opposition in his country, they came back. Well, they had brought a big trip report for the president. Now, it's absolute fantasy to think that two busy men like General Taylor and Mr. McNamara are going to make a quick flying trip all through Vietnam, transversing the Pacific Ocean and everything, and write a great trip report while they go. It would be written right in the Pentagon. But more importantly, it was being written as a result of these meetings, and Kennedy was dictating the policy daily to these people that he met with, his staff in the White House, people from State Department, people from CIA, and the military. And when McNamara and Taylor got back to Hawaii, a jet carrying the report landed in Hawaii and gave it to him, a big document, big, with leather covered, with President John F. Kennedy on the cover and all that sort of thing. They couldn't have possibly have done that while they were traveling. And then they had the time to review the report as they flew back to Washington, usually a 8-hour, 45-minute trip in those days in one of the Air Force One aircraft. And they left Andrews Field in a helicopter. They arrived on the White House lawn and presented it to the president. It had just left him about 2 days earlier. And here was the trip report. That's October 2nd of 1963. And that trip report contains the information that Kennedy had approved that he was going to bring 1,000 men home by Christmas time. That's 1,000 military men. And by the end of 65, the bulk of U.S. personnel. Now, bureaucracy is an interesting thing. We learn what certain words mean. If he had said he would bring home the bulk of American military personnel, you would assume that the military personnel were there. So he'd bring in America. And most people who write about that period say Kennedy was going to bring home or not bring home. He was going to, they were, used the word, they were going to withdraw the soldiers. Well, they weren't going to withdraw them. They weren't there. Withdraw is not the word. That's wrong. And many people have been writing for The Nation magazine and other magazines like that trying to explain Kennedy's mind, overlooked the fact that we very carefully inserted into that document, bring home the U.S. personnel. And what did that mean? The CIA people were coming out. So again, that lowered the boom on the CIA, and this time it was the last time. They were going to be out of covert operation completely. So NSAM 55 began the movement of getting CIA out, and 263 closed the book on it. And by 65, he would have had no CIA people in Vietnam at all. And they'd been there since 45. So you see a good long period of time, 20 years. And in other countries, too, he would have stopped them from being in covert operations overseas. It's very fundamental points that if you look in the right books and at the right reports, you get them all, and they're all backed up. These are not my words. I happen to be there, and I happen to be working in them. But this series, especially this latest book that had just been released, gives you the answers to what people have been looking for years. But the trouble is that during this period, countless history books have been written about Kennedy, about Vietnam, about the post-war period, about the Cold War. And the writers have not used this sort of material. And unfortunately, the books are, what will we call them, fantasy or mythology?
Concoction.
Correct. I belong to the Society of Historians for American Foreign Relations, a wonderful organization of thousands of mostly history professors all throughout the country. And as we have our annual meetings, one of the complaints that arises more frequently than any other is the quality of history books today. Quality meaning, are they true? Are they revisionist? There's more things been written about Kennedy that are absolutely untrue since his death. There's no sense of killing a guy twice, once with a gun and once with a typewriter. And they're untrue. And what I think people ought to do is refer to the work of these generals, like this report at the Bay of Pigs, or refer to these works, papers from the State Department. They're listed as the Foreign Relations of the United States. And see what the facts are. Or refer to some of the gentlemen that are mentioned in here who are still with us, God bless them, because those are the important things. And that tells us what really happened. And this is why when I worked with Oliver Stone, we were working from this kind of paper, and that's what stirred up so much opposition. Because when these big-time writers in the New York Times and the Washington Post and other papers said, there is no substantive history to back up what Stone's putting in the film, all I need to do is read these books. There's the substantive history. And it's appalling to think that these men who work every day on the minds of the American public with their computer writing through the New York Times and the Washington Post and the rest of them are telling us that sort of thing when they know very well what they're saying is not true. It's too bad, but it's not true.
And as you were saying before, the Taylor McNamara report, which became, in essence, the formalized text for 263. You were involved working under Krulak in writing a lot of what became their report that they gave back to Kennedy when they arrived on the White House lawn, that was derived from all these meetings.
Yes, and you know, people have to understand when you talk about the Joint Chiefs of Staff, there's an organization called the Joint Staff. Now, in my day, by law, it could not exceed 400 people. And so I was one of 400. And people say, well, what's your job? Our job is to do this kind of thing. When General Krulak would come back, he'd throw notes on the table before five or six of us, or even tape record, cassette recording. And he'd say, there's what we did today. Now, look, each one of you do such and such a part you've been working on, and we'll get this report the way the president wants it. Right. And when it was the way the president wanted it, that's when it went out to Hawaii to Taylor and McNamara, so that when it came back, the president was ready to sign it as his policy for Vietnam, which was he was not going to put American troops into Vietnam. Where we put, do you know how many troops were really in Vietnam? 2,600,000. And 58,000 were killed, let alone all the other people that were killed.
By the time it was all done?
By the time the Vietnam War was over, 2,600,000 men had been rotated through Vietnam. We don't very often think about that. We dropped more bombs from aircraft in Vietnam, in Indochina, than all of World War II. People don't have any idea what Vietnam really got to be after the death of Kennedy. Well, in all of those big numbers that I'm talking about, the money that rolled out went at least to $570 billion. Now, if Kennedy had not died, he would not have put those people there, not just the 500,000 that were there at any one given day, but the 2,600,000. And if the people didn't go, they would not have had to spend the $570 billion. Well, there were men, as General Eisenhower said in his great speech, which was the opening of the Stone filmed.
That's great.
That beware of the military-industrial complex. And when you threaten such a complex with the potential of $570 billion, and then you're going to bring it down to nothing, you are bound to get some hot-headed decisions. And the removal of the president is not a very difficult thing to do. Just think of the list of presidents who've been wounded, shot at, killed since World War II. A lot of people don't know that, even President Carter was threatened with assassination. And President Reagan had a bullet in him. It's a very, very different world when we don't use things in a factual basis and really know what's going on, because then the public is so badly confused. Plus in debt. Confused and deeply in debt. You know, I don't have... My book is here. I don't know whether I can... But in the book, I could show you, just to make a point, because I knew the document, I inserted in this book of mine the picture of these men coming back to Washington with this report. It's on the coffee table in the president's office. And if anybody thinks that that huge report could have been written while they were running from one place to another in Vietnam, you see that big report on the coffee table in front of the president and Maxwell Taylor and McNamara there? Well, that is the report of the trip. They couldn't have done that on the back of envelopes while they were running.
Right.
And it was very carefully designed by Kennedy to support his Vietnam policy, you
right.
see. He had no... It's like saying he was to blame for not providing air cover for the Cubans. Here's something people are saying: he had no policy for Vietnam. He was going to... The thing that's very interesting about Kennedy's death and this work, there was a meeting convened in Honolulu on the 20th of November, 1963. Very strange meeting, because 60 leaders of our government, including the ambassador from Saigon, among others, and all of Kennedy's cabinet had gone to Honolulu. And they had this meeting about what to do in the future with the Vietnam War. Despite the fact that this existed, there was this meeting about the Vietnam War. The interesting thing is that the report that they released that day, November 20th, and published in the New York Times, among other papers, on the 21st, is a glowing report of how things were becoming better in Vietnam. And yet, on the same day, November 21st, 1963, a report was written called NSAM 273, which was reversing some of the Kennedy policy for Vietnam. And yet, hypothetically, this NSAM, new NSAM, would have to be signed by Kennedy. And yet, the Honolulu meeting was providing Kennedy with assurances that everything was going well. So could it be that this NSAM 273 was somehow signaling a change, which of course by March of 1973, when NSAM 288 came out under Lyndon Johnson, escalated the war to what we saw later.
Now, you said March of 83. You mean March of 64?
No, March of 64.
March of 64.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
March of 64. But you can see the changes in it. And some of these people have said, again referring to the Kennedy policy of not putting America, not withdrawing America, but not putting Americans in. Withdrawal was bringing the boys home for Christmas. But not putting them in. They completely overlook this rapid change. It came right about the time the president was killed. And to me, it just underscores terrifically the way history books are worked on. In 1967, sort of summing up all of this Vietnam period. Secretary McNamara of the Defense Department ordered a group to write the history of the U.S. in Vietnam from 1945, notice the date he picks, 45, to the present. And the present would be when they got it done, the end of 1968. So, rather in a chronological manner, they wrote what amount to being five volumes this size of this history of the United States, a history written by people in the Pentagon, paid for by the U.S. government, and published by the U.S. government. It's called the Pentagon Papers. Because it is the same stack of highly classified papers that Daniel Ellsberg released to the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Washington Post, and a few other papers. And, of course, Ellsberg got in serious trouble for violating security and releasing this, which, of course, was very good advertising for this. Because this was put together, as it states clearly in the opening paragraphs, by a man named Les Gelb. Gelb was working in the internal security agency offices of the Office of the Secretary of Defense.
Okay.
That's where he was working. It also just happens that if you look in the Pentagon telephone books of the period, you find that not only is Mr. Gelb listed in ISA, but Daniel Ellsberg is listed in the Pentagon telephone books. And anybody that has enough interest to want to read history should just look in these books, because a lot of other nice names in here. General Richard Secord was working in the same office. Mr. Eagleburger, the State Department, was working in the same office.
ISA.
Bill Bundy was working. Bill Bundy was the head of it for a while. ISA. They had a little robin's nest there that was bringing out all these things. But something that I want to emphasize on this business of history, because most history professors, and therefore, unfortunately, most history students, believe that the Pentagon Papers are the essence of the Vietnam War period, and that if they study these, they know what went on. And the book is written in chronology, like the page I'm open to here has the 3rd of November, the 4th of November, and over here on this page, 9th of November, the 20th of November, the Honolulu Conference, the conference I was talking to you about, with all the people out there. The entire country team met with Rusk, McNamara, Taylor, Bundy, Bell. So I have a copy of a letter Bundy wrote in 1991. This is McGeorge Bundy, saying he wasn't there. Here he listed. Maybe the history book's wrong. But it's real interesting. They right up to the 20th. Then on the 22nd of November, 1963, on a blank slate in the Pentagon, they wrote this. Lodge confers with the president. 22nd of November. Having flown to Washington the day after the conference, Lodge meets with the president and presumably continues the kind of report given in Honolulu. 23 November 1963, NSAM 273. Drawing together the results of the Honolulu conference and Lodge's meeting with the president, NSAM 273 reaffirms the U.S. commitment to defeat the Viet Cong in South Vietnam. But what's missing? The men that wrote this wrote it in 1968. They hadn't heard that Kennedy had died. They didn't even know Kennedy was missing. When Lodge confers with the president, they didn't clarify whether he met with Kennedy or Johnson or neither. This is how history is written today. You see? And such things as that are very powerful in the minds of people in college today who are too young to know the things that I can remember about General Walter Beadle Smith or General Ridgway or General Bradley or Alan Dulles. I've worked in Alan Dulles' home with him. I know what Alan Dulles thinks about various things. I've worked with him in John Foster Dulles' home. Well, why can't we tell it the way it is? Why can't we tell it truthfully? So on the 22nd of November, according to this five-volume study done by 36 PhDs working with Les Gelb, who is been the managing editor of the New York Times, among other things. On the 22nd of November, they didn't even notice that the President of the United States had been shot. And the rest of our history books are just about that good. It's terrible. It's a disaster.
A disaster, that is, if you're interested in promulgating the truth. We're going to hear in our second hour from Dave Emery, who's been at this for decades. It's quite a different style to our usual presentation of material. It does settle down after about 10 or 15 minutes, and I think really hits his stride, outlining the Underground Reich, his label for Nazi-oriented deep state milieu, the Gehlen Organization, which we haven't really looked at on Unwelcome Guests, but which does appear to be quite important in the development of the deep state. Now, particularly if you're at all interested in open source privacy on the internet through Tor or other software, I urge you to keep listening. I'm impressed by the observations he makes about the Broadcasting Board of Governors and their connections to so-called internet privacy advocates. I've edited the second broadcast very slightly for time. As usual, the website points to the original source material. That's unwelcomeguests.net/740. This is episode 902 of For the Record, entitled
The Underground Reich and the Deep Politics of the CIA, quote, Privacy Advocates, unquote. Update on the adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook. This is being recorded on April 27th of the year 2016. We are going to update the very complex and both geographically and temporally far-reaching facets of L'Affaire Snowden, the intelligence operation being fronted for by Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, an individual I have also termed the Peach Fuzz Fascist, because he is just exactly that, and the Obverse Oswald, because he is just exactly that as well. Whereas Lee Harvey Oswald was trafficked around, including to the former Soviet Union, then framed for killing President Kennedy, something he did not do, and killed before he could defend himself, and then portrayed as a lone nut slash communist slash Marxist villain from that point forward. So, too, Eddie the Friendly Spook has been trafficked around internationally, only instead of being framed for a crime and labeled a villain and eliminated, he has been portrayed as a hero and has, through his actions, been the front man or the point element of a far-ranging intelligence operation which has a number of goals, the destabilization of the Obama administration, the deep-sixing of the Obama administration's reboot with Russia. It foreshadowed military and political and economic confrontation with China. It is also an assault on some of the very high-tech industries in the U.S. that have responded by increasing encryption. And basically, they have fallen into the trap that Eddie the Friendly Spook has laid for them. It also was, as a major goal, intended to destabilize the NSA and also to facilitate Germany's inclusion in the Five Eyes spying network, also sometimes called the Echelon network or system as well. It's a very deep, complex operation, one of the most important political phenomena of our time, and one that has been fundamentally misunderstood. I've done an awful lot of shows about Snowden and L'Affaire Snowden, as I call it. There is nowhere near time enough to go into them. They are archived on the SpitfireList.com website, along with long article-length written descriptions featuring the various texts. What we're going to be doing in this show is recapping a number of elements that we have examined in the past in order to help understand some of the historical evolution underlying aspects of L'Affaire Snowden. Something to think about in this context, as we will be examining what I call the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich that went underground after World War II and that has perpetuated itself in a very effective fashion in the decades since. The Mafia, it began as a resistance movement in 12th and 13th century Sicily to Norse and Saracen invaders, basically Viking and Turkish invaders in 12th and 13th century Sicily. It then perpetuated itself, spread around the world, and of course no one disputes the existence of the Mafia or its influence, not only in the U.S., but in its native Sicily and elsewhere in Italy and Europe. If someone had proposed to a political researcher, perhaps in the 12th or 13th century, that the Mafia would have perpetuated itself centuries later and around the globe, including on continents that had yet to be discovered, they might have been met with incredulity. They would have been called perhaps conspiracy theorists. And, you know, well, dude, like, okay, the Mafia is a resistance movement in Sicily to Norse and Saracen invaders, but like, dude, it is not going to exist in the year 2000, and it isn't going to be in places we haven't even discovered yet. Like, that is too wild a conspiracy theory, dude. Well, it is not a theory. It is a fact, albeit one that is characterized, obviously, by conspiratorial process. The Third Reich did the same thing and was really in a better position to do so because of the profound connections between the Third Reich and powerful institutions in the West, and also in a big way because of the Cold War. And what we're going to be examining in this program is some of the deep politics and the evolution of elements of the Underground Reich, in particular the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit from World War II, how these networks meshed in with CIA psychological warfare and propaganda outfits, how they dovetailed with the Republican Party, and how these networks have evolved and moved through time. Because as we have seen in other programs about the adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, the milieu, my favorite word, that to which Eddie belongs is basically a CIA-evolved milieu. Snowden was actually working for the CIA in Geneva, Switzerland, when by his own account he was inspired to infiltrate the NSA and to spill its secrets, so to speak. Edward Snowden is not only not what he represents himself as being, but is an extreme right-winger who was adamantly against leaking, hated Obama, thinks we should abolish Social Security, thinks high unemployment is just fine. He basically is, if anything, to the right of the current team of Republican presidential nominees. As incredible as it may seem, he's actually to the right of Donald Trump, who at least nominally gives lip service to preserving Social Security. Not so Eddie the Friendly Spook. And the interests around him from Ron Paul and the neo-Confederate movement, deeply connected to Eddie the Friendly Spook and the elements underlying him, to Glenn Greenwald, who, like Edward Snowden, is the opposite of what he has been represented as being, to the WikiLeaks crowd. They are the opposite of what they have been represented as being. But something we are going to be taking up again in this program is the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which has evolved from the CIA's various radio broadcasting outlets, such as Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and Radio Free Asia. These networks, in turn, as we shall see, are inextricably linked in their genesis and operations with the Underground Reich and the Galen spy outfit. You'll notice that in many of the tech controversies, so to speak, for example, L'Affaire Snowden, everybody was going, oh, my God, the NSA, ooh, the NSA, ooh, 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 the NSA, ooh, the NSA, ooh, the NSA. And now in connection with the Apple iPhone hacking case that was the focal point of controversy after the San Bernardino shootings, everybody's calling out, ooh, the FBI, ooh, ooh, the FBI, ooh, my God, the FBI, the FBI. But nobody is saying, ooh, ooh, the CIA, ooh, 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 the CIA, watch out, the CIA. And when one looks at the milieu, not only of Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, but what I have called the CIA, quote, privacy advocates, unquote, one is looking at a CIA-derived milieu that is at the core of much of the privacy, unquote, discussion, and that evolved from the CIA broadcasting networks. Two of the key concepts, the BBG, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is the U.S. government, in effect, holding company for the various CIA broadcast psychological warfare outlets and fronts, and also the OTF, the Open Technology Fund. What we're going to be looking at, or really sort of asking the question, is to what extent is the milieu of Eddie the Friendly Spook not only a CIA milieu, it certainly is, but to what extent what I have discussed in the past, the focal point networks that grew within the CIA and through CIA, other branches of government, including the military, under Alan Dulles. In turn, we're going to be taking a look at the Galen Group's links with the Underground Reich and with the Bormann Network, and we're going to ask to what extent the Underground Reich has gained control of the CIA focal point networks, basically a secret government within the U.S. government that many of the branches itself are not aware of. So what we're looking at, to what extent is L'Affaire Snowden a manifestation at one level of the CIA focal point networks and at another level of Underground Reich / Galen Org / BND / Bormann Network co-option / infiltration of the CIA focal point networks?
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
We're going to begin by reviewing a portion of a text that we have examined in the past. This is from a book called JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters by James W. Douglas, D-O-U-G-L-A-S-S, published in soft cover by Touchstone Books. Douglas writes about the genesis of the focal point networks. We've read this in the past. Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, an Air Force colonel, was charged by Alan Dulles during the 1950s with putting together what were known as focal point networks, a focal point network within various government agencies, in particular the military. People who were actually CIA officers were infiltrated and tagged for special use within these various branches of the military and other parts of the government, although nominally, you know, military, FAA, what have you. They were actually CIA and answered to CIA in many cases without the full knowledge or any knowledge by the agencies, including military agencies, to which they belonged ostensibly. And what we're going to do is to jump in, and we're going to examine the distillate, so to speak, of Prouty-Dulles genesis of the focal point networks. From JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters by James W. Douglas. Douglas got L. Fletcher Privy to create a network of subordinate focal point offices in the armed services and then throughout the entire U.S. government. Each office that Privy set up was put under a cleared, unquote, CIA employee. That person took orders directly from the CIA but functioned under the cover of his particular office and branch of government. Such, quote, breeding, unquote, Privy said decades later in an interview, resulted in a web of covert CIA operatives in the State Department, in the FAA, in the Customs Service, in the Treasury, in the FBI, and all around through the government up to and in the White House. Then we began to assign people there who those agencies thought were from the Defense Department, but they actually were people that we put there from the CIA. The consequence in the early 1960s when Kennedy became president was that the CIA had placed a secret team of its own employees throughout the entire U.S. government. It was accountable to no one except the CIA, headed by Alan Dulles. After Dulles was fired by Kennedy, the CIA's deputy director of plans, Richard Helms, became this invisible government's immediate commander. No one except the tight inner circle of the CIA even knew of the existence of this top-secret intelligence network, much less the identity of its deep-cover bureaucrats. These CIA focal points, unquote, as Dulles called them, constituted a powerful, unseen government within the government. Its Dulles-appointed members would act quickly, with total obedience when called on by the CIA to assist its covert operations. Part of the upshot of that, of course, is that ultimately the CIA began operating domestically and instituting or playing a primary role in coups d'etat here as they had abroad, President Kennedy's murder being just one of those coups. So, as we look at the CIA background of Eddie Snowden and the people around him, the so-called privacy advocates, bear in mind the focal point networks. Now we're going to review some information about the BBG and about the CIA genesis of the propaganda networks that are the parent of the CIA milieu of these, quote, privacy advocates, unquote. From the Pando Daily of March 1st of 2015, an article by Yasha Levine, L-E-V-I-N-E, Internet Privacy Funded by Spooks, A Brief History of the BBG, unquote. Again, by Yasha, Y-A-S-H-A, last name Levine, L-E-V-I-N-E, from the Pando Daily of 3-1-2015. It reads in part, for the past few months, I've been covering U.S. government funding of popular internet privacy tools like Tor, CryptoCat, and OpenWhisper systems. During my reporting, one agency in particular keeps popping up, an agency with one of those really bland names that masks its wild, bizarre history, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, or BBG. The BBG was formed in 1999 and runs on a $721 million annual budget. It reports directly to Secretary of State John Kerry and operates like a holding company for a host of Cold War CIA spinoffs and old-school psychological warfare projects, Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Asia, Radio MAPT, Voice of America, Radio Liberation from Bolshevism, since renamed Radio Liberty, and a dozen other government-funded radio stations and media outlets pumping out pro-American propaganda across the globe. Today, the congressionally funded federal agency is also one of the biggest backers of grassroots and open-source internet privacy technology. That sentence again. Today, this congressionally funded federal agency is also one of the biggest backers of grassroots and open-source internet privacy technology. Privacy here belongs in some big quotes. Continuing, These investments started in 2012 when the BBG launched the Open Technology Fund, or OTF, an initiative housed within and run by Radio Free Asia, or RFA, a premier BBG property that broadcasts in the communist countries like North Korea, Vietnam, Laos, China, and Myanmar. The BBG endowed Radio Free Asia's Open Technology Fund with a multi-billion-dollar budget and a single task: to fulfill the U.S. congressional global mandate for Internet freedom, unquote. It's already a mouthful of proverbial Washington alphabet soup. Congress funds BBG to fund RFA to fund OTF, but regardless of which subgroup ultimately writes the check. The important thing to understand is that all this federal government money flows directly or indirectly from the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Between 2012 and 2014, Radio Free Asia's Open Technology Fund poured more than $10 million into Internet privacy projects, big and small. Open-source encrypted communication apps, next-generation secure email initiatives, anti-censorship mesh networking platforms, encryption security audits, secure cloud hosting, a network of high-capacity Tor exit nodes, and even an anonymous Tor-based tool for leakers and whistleblowers that competed with WikiLeaks. Though many of the apps and tech-backed Radio Free Asia's OTF are unknown to the general public, they are highly respected and extremely popular among the anti-surveillance internet activist crowd. OTF-funded apps have been recommended by Edward Snowden, covered favorably by ProPublica and the New York Times technology reporters, and repeatedly promoted by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Everyone seems to agree that OTF-funded privacy apps offer some of the best protection from government surveillance you can get. In fact, just about all the featured open-source apps on EFF's recent secure messaging scorecard were funded by OTF. Parenthetically, I think it is probable that there is a backdoor in these various privacy tools, unquote, which makes them altogether accessible to the agencies that have run them. Continuing some of the background here, continuing with the Yasha Levine article. But why, skipping down, why is a federally funded CIA spinoff with decades of experience in psychological warfare suddenly blowing tens of millions in government funds on privacy tools meant to protect people from being surveilled by another arm of the very same government? To answer that question, we have to pull the camera back and examine how all of those Cold War propaganda outlets that begat the Broadcasting Board of Governors, begat Radio Free Asia, begat the Open Technology Fund. The story begins in the late 1940s. And as you listen to what I'm about to read, bear in mind the focal point networks and, as we will see, the underground Reich infiltration of, and I believe ultimately co-option of, much of the U.S. intelligence system. The Broadcasting Board of Governors traces its beginnings to the early Cold War years as a covert propaganda project of the newly created CIA to wage psychological warfare against communist regimes and others deemed a threat to U.S. interests. George Kennan, K-E-N-N-A-N, the key architect of post-World War II foreign policy, pushed for expanding the role of covert peacetime programs. And so in 1948, National Security Council Directive 10/2 officially authorized the CIA to engage in covert operations against the communist menace. Clause 5 of the directive defined covert operations as propaganda, economic warfare, preventive direct action, including sabotage, anti-sabotage, demolition and evacuation measures, subversion against hostile states, including assistance to underground resistance movements, guerrillas, and refugee liberation groups, and support of the indigenous anti-communist elements in threatened countries of the free world, unquote. Propaganda quickly became one of the key weapons of the CIA's covert operations arsenal. The agency established and funded radio stations, newspapers, magazines, historical societies, emigre, quote, research institutes, unquote, and cultural programs all over Europe. In many cases, it funneled money to outfits run and staffed by known World War II criminals and Nazi collaborators both in Europe and here in the U.S. Christopher Simpson, author of Blowback, America's Recruitment of Nazis and Its Destructive Impact on Our Domestic and Foreign Policy, details the extent of these psychological warfare projects. CIA-funded psychological warfare projects employing Eastern European emigres became major operations during the 1950s, consuming tens and even hundreds of millions of dollars. This included underwriting most of the French Pays et Liberté movement, paying the bills of the German League for Struggle Against Inhumanity, and financing a half-dozen free jurists' associations, a variety of European federalist groups, the Congress for Cultural Freedom, magazines, news services, book publishers, and much more. These were very broad programs designed to influence world public opinion at virtually every level, from illiterate peasants in the fields to the most sophisticated scholars in prestigious universities. They drew on a wide range of sources: labor unions, advertising agencies, college professors, journalists, and student leaders, to name a few. In Europe, the CIA set up Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberation from Bolshevism, later renamed Radio Liberty, which beamed propaganda in several languages into the Soviet Union and Soviet satellite states of Eastern Europe. The CIA later expanded its radio propaganda operations into Asia, targeting Communist China, North Korea, and Vietnam. The spy agency also funded several radio projects aimed at subverting leftist governments in Central and South America, including Radio Free Cuba and Radio SWAN, S-W-A-N, which was run by the CIA and employed some of the same Cuban exiles that took part in the failed Bay of Pigs invasion. Even today, the CIA boasts that these early psychological warfare projects, quote, would become one of the longest-running and successful covert action programs ever mounted by the U.S. Officially, note that term, officially the CIA's direct role in this global psychological warfare project diminished in the 1970s after the spy agency's ties to Cold War propaganda arms like Radio Free Europe were exposed. Congress agreed to take over funding of these projects from the CIA, and eventually Washington expanded them into a massive, federally funded apparatus. The names of the various CIA spinoffs and nonprofits changed over the years, culminating in a 1999 reorganization under President Bill Clinton, which created the Broadcasting Board of Governors, a parent holding company to group new broadcasting operations around the world, together with Cold War-era propaganda outfits with spooky pasts, including Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Voice of America, and Radio Free Asia. In that context, do not forget the focal point networks. It is a very good bet that in Congress, even in the White House, and everywhere else throughout the government, those focal point networks were still in operation. Note that Alan Dulles was replaced as head of the CIA, well, initially by John McCone, but ultimately by Richard Helms, who was the deputy director for plans and had actually been in charge of the MKUltra and other mind control projects for CIA. Now, note again that one of the fronts here is Radio Liberty, formerly Radio Liberation from Bolshevism. We're now going to review the projection, again by Alan Dulles, formerly of Sullivan and Cromwell, arguably the most important of the CIA elite, or the Wall Street elite law firms, along with his brother John Foster, again from Sullivan and Cromwell. We're going to look at how this milieu, including, as we will see, Radio Liberty, were projected into the American political theater and into the Republican Party, where they became the dominant element. Reviewing again, and we've reviewed this a couple of times in recent weeks, from The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, copyright 1994 by Mark Ahrens and published in hard and soft cover by the St. Martin's Press. John Loftus, by the way, was in charge of the Justice Department's Office of Special Investigations, looking into Nazi war criminals in the U.S. He quit in 1980 when the incoming Reagan administration, by his own account, as we will see, was the administration filled with the very interest that he had been investigating. We're going to jump in here. After Truman narrowly defeated Thomas Dewey in 1948, Alan Dulles, who was Dewey's campaign manager, and a young Dulles protege named Richard Nixon, began to put together the fascist freedom fighter branch of the Republican Party, skipping down. Vice President Nixon's secret political war of Nazis against Jews in American politics was never investigated at the time. The foreign language speaking Croatians and other fascist emigre groups had a ready-made network for contacting and mobilizing the Eastern European ethnic bloc. There is a very high correlation between CIA domestic subsidies to fascist freedom fighters during the 1950s and the leadership of the Republican Party's ethnic campaign groups. The motive for the under-the-table financing was clear. Nixon used Nazis to offset the Jewish vote for the Democrats, skipping down again. In 1952, Nixon formed an ethnic division within the Republican National Committee, displaced fascists hoping to be returned to power by an Eisenhower-Nixon liberation policy signed on with the committee. In 1953, when Republicans were in office, the immigration laws were changed to admit Nazis and even members of the SS. They flooded into the country, and Nixon himself oversaw the new immigration program. More about this program and some of the key people in it. As a young movie actor in the early 1950s, Ronald Reagan was employed as the public spokesperson for an Office of Policy Coordination front named the Crusade for Freedom. Reagan may not have known it, but 99% of the Crusade's funds came from clandestine accounts, which were then laundered through the Crusade to various organizations such as Radio Liberty, which employed Dulles' fascists. Bill Casey, who later became CIA director under Ronald Reagan, parenthetically, who was also Reagan's campaign manager in 1980, also worked in Germany after World War II on Dulles' Nazi Freedom Fighters program. When he returned to New York, Casey headed up another OPC front, the International Rescue Committee, which sponsored the immigration of these fascists to the U.S. Casey's committee replaced the International Red Cross as the sponsor for Dulles' recruits. And as we have also seen, the Nazi branch of the Republican Party formed by Richard Nixon and Alan Dulles and fronted for by Ronald Reagan and facilitated by William Casey was made a permanent branch of the Republican Party in 1973 when George H.W. Bush was head of the Republican National Committee. So when the 1980 election season rolled around, we had Ronald Reagan, the key front person for the fascist Freedom Fighters program under the Crusade for Freedom. Running for president, we had George H.W. Bush, who made the Nazi branch of the Republican Party permanent when he was head of the RNC. The campaign was managed by William Casey, who assisted the program. Casey then became head of the CIA. Also, most of Reagan's early cabinet appointees, such as Caspar Weinberger, George Shultz, General Alexander Haig, Richard Allen, the first Reagan National Security Advisor, they were all Richard Nixon cabinet veterans. And note the role of organizations like Radio Liberty in laundering funds for this operation and in helping to employ some of the Dulles imported fascists. By way of understanding the Galen organization and the Underground Reich's seminal role in the genesis of this milieu, which ultimately was to coalesce in the late 90s into the Broadcasting Board of Governors and which spawned this CIA parented milieu that was spoken about in the Yasha Levine article. We're going to jump back 32 years into the archives, and we're going to listen to a portion of AFA number 3, recorded in June of 1984, about the Reinhard Gehlen spy organization. You will also hear, in addition to my own voice, the voice of my very competent and charming former co-host, Nip Tuck, whose on-air duties were essential to the realization of the archive shows. And note the foundational involvement of Gehlen in the genesis of these networks. This again from AFA number 3, recorded in June of 1984.
Now, Radio Free Europe, of course, was involved in broadcasting propaganda to the Soviet Union and Eastern Bloc countries. And Reinhard Gehlen figured very prominently in the formation of Radio Free Europe.
You may also remember, those of you who do follow the news, that Radio Free Europe has shown up several times lately in the news during the past couple of years because of a resurgence of, it's hard to say politicization because it's obviously a political thing, but apparently the political control of Radio Free Europe has gotten rather heavy-handed under the Reagan administration. We're going to touch on some more recent aspects too, but first we're going to give you some of the early history and some of the Gehlen connections. This first section is from a book called Gehlen, Spy of the Century by E.H. Cookridge, and this is copyright 1971, published by Random House. The Soviet blockade of Berlin was accompanied by violent and effective propaganda by radio leaflets and newspapers, which was aimed at frightening West Berliners and West Germans and weakening their trust in the Allies. Hitherto, the latter had made hardly any answer to this concerted propaganda assault. Wisner, who is Frank Wisner, who we've discussed in previous broadcasts, high-ranking American intelligence official, who had early contacts with the Nazis and bringing them into the intelligence system. Wisner, advised by Gehlen and several of his radio experts, immediately went to work to remedy this situation. A powerful radio transmitter was to be established to counteract communist aggression over the ether. Even when the initial plans were still being drafted, Wisner was envisaging a chain of transmitters broadcasting in all the languages of the many nations within the Soviet orbit, which would fan discontent and encourage opposition and open rebellion against the communist rulers. Initially, there was only one American medium which could be used. This was RIAS. Radio in the American sector, the official transmitter of the U.S. military commander in Berlin. It limited its transmission to brief bulletins, news talks, and a great deal of musical entertainment. Wisner had little difficulty in impressing upon Major General Frank L. Howley, the sector commandant, that RIAS programs must be radically revised. Gehlen provided a few experienced broadcasters, which soon brought more zip into the transmissions. But the plan of the great transmitter took some time. Wisner was unable to obtain from his superiors. He turned to American business tycoons for help. Alan Dulles, whom President Truman had asked to head a committee of three to investigate the effectiveness of Hillenkoetter's CIA, willingly offered his help. The two company lawyers passed the begging bowl along with splendid success. At that time, several private bodies in the United States, such as the Council on Foreign Relations, the Council Against Communist Aggression, Congress for Cultural Freedom, American Friends of Russian Freedom, the Free Asia Committee, and a number of, quote, citizens' committees in several states and cities, some of which were to lend support to Senator Joseph McCarthy, were engaged in fighting communism in their own fashion. Dulles and Wisner enlisted the prestigious help of General Eisenhower, who had retired from his post as U.S. Chief of Staff to become the president of Columbia University, and assembled the Free Europe Committee, whose list of sponsors read like a who's who of American industry and banking. Headed by Alan Valentine, erstwhile Yale history professor and Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, who had gone into big business and was a director of the Finance Securities Trust Company, the American Sulphur Corporation, and the Buffalo-Rochester-Pittsburgh Railroad, they included Clark McAdams Clifford, a director of the National Bank of Washington, C. Rodney Smith, president of American Airlines, Frank Altschul, senior partner in the banking house of Lazard Frères, C. D. Jackson of the Luce Organization, publishers of Time, Life, and Fortune magazines, A. F. Francis, chairman of the General Food Corporation, the world's largest breakfast cereal manufacturers, Henry Ford II, Edwin H. Land, president of Polaroid, and William O. Baker, vice president of the Bell Telephones Corporation. There were many more willing donors, amongst them General Motors, General Electric, Westinghouse, Chrysler, United Food, and all the oil companies, headed by Esso and Standard Oil.
So those are some of the people that Wisner turned to get the funds that he was unable to get from his immediate superiors in the early days of the CIA. Continuing now with the history of Radio Free Europe. Early in 1950, Radio Free Europe was installed in a row of prefabricated buildings in the Englischer Garten, a pleasant park in the center of Munich. Within an amazingly brief period, with an initial budget of $10 million, Radio Free Europe began its transmissions from its new powerful station. It also used existing transmitters in several friendly countries. In the course of time, Radio Free Europe grew into a chain of 29 radio stations, beaming round-the-clock anti-communist propaganda in 16 languages to East Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, and the former Baltic states. Broadcasts in Albanian were eventually discontinued when it was discovered that there were very few radio receivers in Albania. A chain of transmitters was also set up in Saudi Arabia, Iran, Pakistan, Thailand, Vietnam, Indonesia, and Japan, which cover the Middle East, Africa, Asiatic Russia, Southeast Asia, and the Far East. From Frankfurt, the War of the Ether was initiated by a kindred foundation, Radio Liberty, which broadcast exclusively to the Soviet Union in a multitude of its languages and dialects, from Russian, Ukrainian, Ruthenian, Finnish, and Latvian, to Turkoman, Tajik, Chuvak, and the Ural-Altaic dialects of Mongolia. The official Voice of America completed the mighty barrage, catering for listeners with sufficient knowledge of English. Galen eagerly cooperated from the very outset with Radio Free Europe and its supervisors from the Office of Policy Coordination, Colonel Kotek and William Griffith. He delegated as his liaison officer ex-SA Bonfuhrer Peter Fischer, who went under the alias of Major Fiedler. He had become the chief radio expert at Pulak and could boast excellent credentials. During the war, he had served in the SD in the Netherlands under SS Sturmbannführer Josef Schreider, who had been instrumental in conducting Funkspiel radio deceptions with London, succeeding in catching, by the use of fake signals, nearly every SOE agent sent to the Dutch resistance from England, and also the leaders of the Resistance Council. SOE, by the way, is the British Special Operations Executive, which conducted covert operations in mainland Europe during the war. And a fellow by the name of William Stevenson, who we're going to refer to later in the broadcast, was a member of that organization, and he wrote about Galen as well. So Galen was instrumental in setting up Radio Free Europe, which basically broadcast to the communist countries and was ostensibly presenting them with the view of freedom. And it's worth noting the heavy Galen links with this organization, because there are indications that basically these Radio Free Europe Galen links have been maintained, at least to a certain extent, right up into the last few years. Now, in the second of our Radio Free America broadcasts, we talked about a Romanian Iron Gardist, a Romanian fascist, part of the Romanian Native Fascist Movement, sponsored by and allied to Nazi Germany. He was a fellow by the name of, initially, Viorel, and later Valerian Trifa. Now, he worked for Galen near the end of World War II. Eventually, he became the Archbishop of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate and was close to, among others, J. Edgar Hoover and Richard Milhouse Nixon. Specifically, was called upon by Nixon to give the opening prayer before the United States Senate in 1955. Now, he worked for Galen, as we saw in a book called Wanda, the Search for Nazis in America. At the end of World War II, there are indications that he stayed working with the Galen organization when Galen jumped to the United States. And, Valerian Trifa cropped up in the news within several times in the last few years. And, as I said, there are indications that the Galen organization maintains its contacts with Radio Free Europe.
All right, this next selection is an article from the San Francisco Chronicle for Wednesday, February 20th, 1980. This is a Jack Anderson column, and it's entitled RFE, or Radio Free Europe, in Hot Water. And it reads as follows: Radio Free Europe, which gets $85 million from American taxpayers each year for beaming propaganda to the communist world, has touched off a congressional investigation by broadcasting a lengthy interview with an alleged Nazi war criminal and then firing two employees who blew the whistle on the outrageous program. The RFE official directly responsible for the broadcast has not been reprimanded, possibly because he has a close friend and former RFE colleague on the staff of the president's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. Chairman John Granowski of the Board for International Broadcasting, which supervises RFE, has appointed a special counsel to look into the matter. The interview, last May 1st, gave a sympathetic airing to the views of Valerian Trifa. Justice Department documents charge that Trifa, as a leader of the Nazi-oriented Iron Guard in his native Romania, was personally responsible for the deaths of 4,000 Jews in a 1941 pogrom. He eventually came to this country, settled in Detroit, and became a bishop of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate. I should just put in parenthetically here, according to Bloom, whose book Dave mentioned, he got the name Valerian, which is his bishop's name, and got his bishopship, or his bishopric, when he and a bunch of his Iron Guard thugs literally surrounded the house of the present bishop in upstate Michigan, dragged the priests out, beat them with clubs, and literally took over the leadership of the Romanian Orthodox Church, according to Bloom's book, Wanted: The Search for Nazis in America. Anyway, going back to Anderson's article, he eventually came to this country, settled in Detroit, and became a bishop of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate. The Justice Department is trying to deport him on grounds that he lied about his past when he became a U.S. citizen. Congressional investigators, for Representative Elizabeth Holtzman, Democrat of New York, have received evidence that, quote, the broadcast was not simply an inadvertent judgmental error, but represented a conscious management decision made over staff objections. It was, said the investigators, quote, part of a pattern of such questionable decisions with respect to both substance and personnel made over the past several years, unquote. The investigators also found that Radio Free Europe employees, quote, have been harassed and threatened for attempting publicly to expose what they consider to be the facts of this case, unquote. Indeed, two employees in the Romanian broadcast division, Edgar Raphael and Jacob Popper, have been fired, apparently because they told Holtzman about the Trifa situation. Radio Free Europe President Glenn Ferguson ignored a specific directive from Granowski not to fire the two men. Noel Bernard, director of the Romanian service, is still riding high at Radio Free Europe. Sources say he is an old pal of Paul Henze, H-E-N-Z-E, a veteran CIA operative who is now a member of Brzezinski's White House staff. The two served together at Radio Free Europe's Munich station in the 1950s.
Now, again, from AFA number 3 from June of 1984. We should note the perpetuation of that milieu into the present period when, as we looked at in For the Record 901, we see a Croatian Ustashi elements coming to power openly now in Croatia, the part of the former Yugoslavia, when we see the OUNB, World War II era fascists, basically coming to power in Ukraine and criminalizing an accurate reporting of the World War II history in Ukraine, and even more importantly, when we see our media and our political establishment functioning in lockstep in conjunction with what I call the underground Reich, people need to ask themselves how this happened. And the Reagan administration, as we saw, ultimately used the Free Congress Foundation's Liberation branch to project these same elements back into the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. The Galen Org that we have spoken about so many times was a unique organization. We've spoken about its work with CIA, with NATO, with the Federal Republic of Germany, where it remains to this day, with BND officers being hired from the families of former officers, hundreds of which were members of the SS and Gestapo, as we have looked at in a number of programs. We have not, however, taken a look at the work of the Galen Org with Army Intelligence. The first collaborative U.S. agency with the Galen Org was Army Intelligence, thereby facilitating the infiltration of Army intel by these same networks. There's a very good account of this in one of the best recent books about Operation Paperclip, the importation of these Nazis to work for our Defense Department and CIA. Operation Paperclip was authored by Annie Jacobson, J-A-C-O-B-S-E-N, published in hardcover by Little Brown. And there is this account of the Galen Org, its composition, its nature, and its work with Army intelligence. Galen had been in the U.S. under interrogation since 1945. Here at Oberursel, Army intelligence decided to make Galen the head of its entire anti-communist intelligence organization under the codename Operation Rusty, R-U-S-T-Y. Eventually, the organization would simply become known as the Galen Organization, a network of former Nazi intelligence agents, the majority of whom were members of the SS, began working out of offices at Camp King side by side with Army intelligence officers. Colonel William Russell Philp was in charge of overall supervision. By late 1947, the Galen Organization got so large that it required its own headquarters. Army intelligence moved the organization to a self-contained facility outside Munich in a village called Pulak. This compound was the former estate of Martin Bormann and had large grounds, sculpture gardens, and a pool, skipping down. According to documents kept classified for 51 years, relations between Galen and Philp declined and became hostile when Philp finally realized the true nature of who he was dealing with. The Galen Organization was a murderous bunch, freewheeling, unquote, and out of control. As one CIA affiliate observed, American intelligence is a rich blind man using the Abwehr as a seeing eye dog. The only trouble is, the leash is much too long. The Army became fed up with the Galen Organization, but there was no way out. Its operatives were professional double-crossers and liars. Many were also alleged war criminals, and now they had the Army over a barrel. Decades later, it would emerge that General Galen was reportedly earning $1 million a year. Note again that most of these operatives were members of the SS, and note that eventually the Army realized who it was dealing with, but there was nothing they could do because, quote, its operatives were professional double-crossers and liars. The Army, in addition to CIA, in addition to the Republican Party, NATO, and ultimately the Federal Republic of Germany, was one of the institutions corrupted by what was essentially a direct outgrowth of the Third Reich's national security establishment. And turning to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning, available for download for free on the website. Note that about Bormann and his relationship with the Thiessen family and one of the reasons for that. Bormann felt that Fritz Thiessen was his ace in the hole if he ever needed a pipeline to Allen W. Dulles. And note that here. Also from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, even General Galen, when he was chief of the Federal Republic's Intelligence Service, sent his agents to confer with General Heinrich Mueller in South America. And also from that same book, the CIA could have pulled aside the gray curtain that obscured Bormann at any time, but the CIA and former Gestapo chief Heinrich Mueller's crack organization of former SS men found it to their mutual advantage to cooperate in many situations. There is no morality in the sense that most of us know it in the strange world of professional secrecy, and when it was to the advantage of each to work together, they did so. And note also, from the Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt, an article by Carl Oglesby, from Covert Action Information Bulletin number 35 from the fall of 1990, Galen met with Admiral Karl Dönitz, who had been appointed by Hitler as his successor during the last days of the Third Reich. Galen and the Admiral were now in a U.S. Army VIP prison camp in Wiesbaden. Galen sought and received approval from Admiral Dönitz, too. As Galen was about to leave for the U.S., he left a message for Gerhard Bonn with another of his top aides, Gerhard Wessel. I am to tell you from Galen that he has discussed with Hitler's successor, Admiral Karl Dönitz, and Galen Superior and Chief of Staff General Franz Halder the question of continuing his work with the Americans. Both were in agreement. And look at, for historical purposes, who was in charge, who was the congressional liaison to Allen Dulles' CIA in this time period when the Crusade for Freedom, the Fascist Freedom Fighters Program, the genesis of the focal point networks, the gaining of momentum by the various psychological warfare fronts such as Radio Liberty was going on. From the devil's chessboard, Allen Dulles, the CIA, and the rise of America's secret government, we read by David Talbot, we read, Dulles' CIA operated with virtually no congressional oversight. In the Senate, Dulles relied on Wall Street friends like Prescott Bush of Connecticut, the father and grandfather of two future presidents, to protect the CIA's interests. The point being that Prescott Bush, part of the Union Banking Corporation and the various corporate fronts that collaborated with the CIA and collaborated with Nazi Germany, Prescott Bush, along with George Herbert Walker, were deeply involved with those, and that inevitably places them in the, they were business partners of the Thiessens, that places them in the same milieu of the Bormann Network and the Underground Reich. And Prescott Bush was Allen Dulles' main liaison to the Senate. A very interesting development as we take a look at the milieu of Eddie the Friendly Spook. And we find Pierre Omidyar, who generated The Intercept, and that employed Glenn Greenwald, who basically, if you stood next to Glenn Greenwald and threw a rock in the air, the chances are about 90% that rock would land on a Nazi. And as we look at the historical underpinnings for what is now manifesting itself with a new Cold War, with fascist groups dating to World War II, now in ascendance all over Europe and elsewhere, Pierre Omidyar not only helped to fund the Ukrainian coup, he also helped to finance the ascension of Narendra Modi and his Hindu fascist government in India as well. And guess who Pierre Omidyar has employed as an Omidyar fellow. This from the Pando Daily by Mark Ames. What the hell? Pierre Omidyar selects one of Edward Snowden's former Booz Allen bosses to be an Omidyar fellow. This from the Pando Daily of March 16th of 2015. Edward Snowden was a Booz Allen Hamilton employee in Hawaii when he worked as a subcontractor for the NSA and made off with hundreds of thousands of the spy agency's files, skipping down. So it may come as a surprise that billionaire Pierre Omidyar, publisher of The Intercept, which owns the only complete cache of Snowden's NSA secrets, financier of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, where Snowden serves on the board of directors, has just selected one of Snowden's former bosses at Booz Allen's Hawaii branch to join the Omidyar Fellows program. His name is Robert Lietzke, L-I-E-T-Z-K-E, and he's a principal at Booz Allen's Hawaii branch where he worked for over 15 years. So who knows about Robert Lietzke? Might he have been part of the evolved focal point networks? Might he be taking money from her? Perhaps, who knows? I know I couldn't find much about his background. Does he perhaps have an Underground Reich affiliation or genesis? That is obviously conjecture. But it is really interesting that Pierre Omidyar would hire one of Eddie the Friendly Spook's apparent superiors at Booz Allen Hamilton. I would also note that the NSA subcontracts out about 70% of its operations. I sometimes wonder what in the world they were thinking. How could they not have expected to be infiltrated and subverted as an institution? It seems to me to be a perfect blueprint to set the stage for infiltration. So again, to what extent are some of the focal point networks perhaps using funding from the Underground Reich or other networks in not only Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, but also in Gold Warriors by the Seagraves, the role of Axis Loot, the Bormann Network, the Black Eagle Trust, The Golden Lily caches were used to finance covert operations during the Cold War. To what extent were the focal point networks funded and co-opted? And is that what we are looking at with Ralph Snowden? Food for thought and grounds for further research.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Or if you'd like to download them 100 at a time, you can do that from unwelcomeguests.net/downloads. Thanks to Olivier for pointing me to Dave Emery. If you'd like to suggest material for the show, you can contact me on welcome@unwelcomeguests.net. They'll take your money and spread it out equal, just like the Bible and the prophets suggest. With men that go riding to help these poor workers, the rich will cut down like a
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Dismantling Corporations. Richard Grossman was the first person who I met during my work with the International Forum on Globalization, who campaigned on the need to not only regulate corporations, but to dismantle them when they do harm. Grossman said, "We need to remember that the American Revolution was fought less against the king, but against the crown corporations, the Hudson's Bay and East India corporations." In his work with POCLAD, the Project on Corporations, Law and Democracy, and CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, he drove home the point that corporations are chartered by sovereign people. He said that based on that sovereignty, people have a right to take the charter away and revoke corporate personhood. Since the beginning of the Trump administration, corporate power has become even more evident, and friends and listeners asked me to repeat a program that I produced in 2011 on the sad occasion of Richard Grossman's premature death. You may have heard the prior talk in which Grossman astounded his listeners by calling for dismantling the top 300 corporations in the U.S., along with several hundred that are chartered in other countries. Here now is another of his hidden history speeches. I recorded him in Washington, D.C., at the 1996 teach-in, organized by the International Forum on Globalization in the campaign against the World Trade Organization. Richard Grossman.
In the year 1407, the good sovereign King Henry IV of England chartered the Company of Merchant and Adventurers, the ancestor of the East India Company, granting it monopoly control over exports of certain manufactures. The empire started to expand, wealth began to flow into England. In 1553, the crown chartered the Russian Company, granting monopoly privilege over certain trade routes to Russia. The company also got special concessions from the Tsar. In 1553, the Africa Company was chartered, as given special privileges to pursue the slave trade. In 1557, the Spanish Company was chartered, given special privileges and monopolies to control the wine and olive oil trade with Spain and Portugal. In 1578, the Eastland Company was created, given sole privilege to carry on trade with Scandinavian countries. He was also granted additional authority to make laws, impose fines, and imprison people. In 1581, the Levant Company was created to trade with Turkey. In 1592, this company merged with the Turkey Company and the Venice Company, in which Queen Elizabeth was a shareholder, to form the East India Company. In 1605, the East India Company was given a charter in perpetuity and given exclusive rights to trade in specified areas of Europe, East and West Asia, North and West Africa. What was the purpose of these and other global corporations of those days, these chips off the old block of sovereignty? Well, in hindsight, we can be very clear that their mission was to buy cheap, to sell dear, to limit or prevent competition, to vacuum out resources, to display fierce violence and to perpetuate violence to people, species, and places, to destroy existing cultures and social relationships, to replace independence with dependence, to eradicate people's sense of their own histories, to get people to internalize the corporation's values, myths, and worldviews, to create a class of bureaucrats and civil servants to serve their needs, to define people as subjects, objects, property, invisible, or anything else they wanted to define them as, to control all dispute resolution, to raise armies and navies and wage war, to write laws, including laws and doctrines which legalize and institutionalize the corporation's destructive and dominating acts, to enforce laws, to impose punishments, including executions. In other words, to govern, and to govern dictatorially, but with guile. From these hundreds of years of experiences, can't we deduce the nature of the corporate fiction? These corporations didn't just create some excessive harms. They didn't just occasionally exploit. They didn't just drive bargains. They were, by definition, by their nature, oppressors. It's an old story, isn't it? The cults of the few tyrannizing the many. And the many, what about them? Who were they? They were the violated and the dehumanized, the oppressed, the people blocked from being and acting fully human, from participating in their own governance, from defining their own lives, their own work, their own values. Today, the majority of the people in the world are oppressed by the few, and the oppressive vehicle of choice is, guess what? The global corporation. So isn't it time that we started acting like oppressed people? Well, the question is, what kind of oppressed people? The conscious oppressed people or the unconscious oppressed people? Here are some characteristics of the unconscious oppressed people, which I've stolen from Paulo Freire. They believe that the oppressor is the model of humanity. They adopt the oppressor's values. They aspire to be like the most eminent and respectable of the oppressors. They are drawn by the irresistible attraction to the oppressor's way of life, thereby modeling their civic, educational, and other institutions after the oppressor's institutions. They accept the dominance and authority of the oppressors as just and appropriate or as inevitable. They concede to the oppressor basic legal and cultural authority to define investment, production, and work, and to define values and concepts such as progress, efficiency, productivity, sustainability, legal violence, justice, freedom, human rights, liberty, nature, security, property, prosperity, peace, public, private, and personhood. They allow, even encourage, oppressors to educate and entertain their children. They fear governing themselves. They fear to define their own societies. They do not know their own history. They think and talk and strategize in the language of the oppressors. They pursue their grievances only in the dens of the oppressors. They confuse freedom with the maintenance of the status quo. And what about the conscious oppressed? Well, there are people in the process of moving, of uncovering their own histories, especially by examining events and eras glorified or distorted by the oppressors. They're relearning their languages and their culture. They're realizing how naive they have been. They're coming to see their oppression as a distortion of being fully human. That to permit themselves to be treated as objects, as property, as subjects, as invisible, to permit one's community to be treated as a fiefdom, is nuts. Who are joining to help each other to stop regarding the oppressors as abstract forces, as created by God or Mother Nature, who are confronting their realities analytically, teaching themselves by investigations and intentional discussions and authentic action, not merely to curb the worst excesses of the oppressors, but to craft resistance, which is about taking power and legitimacy from the oppressors, and by assuming the authority to govern themselves, who see freedom not just as a gift or as an endowment, but as a process by which they can aspire to create institutions of self-governance, and that they can maintain these institutions by acting responsibly and accountably to one another, who are impatient and also patient. That's the kind of oppressed people that we need to be. And I think as a result of the efforts and struggles versus tyranny and for consciousness of people around the globe, across the centuries and centuries and in recent times, that that's the people who we are becoming. In Freire's words, we're moving toward the historical process as responsible subjects, not as objects, who can work with one another not to grovel for concessions or fawn over the false generosity of the oppressors, but to transform our world. So what does this mean for us today? Well, we have some models that we can use as guides. The triumph of the majority of the people in South Africa, the triumph of the Indian people in India, our own American Revolution. But for each of these events and processes, it's important that we look to see what happened and what didn't happen, just to re-examine the history. Let's look at the American Revolution. Well, actually, take a look at the South African Revolution. I learned the last time the IFG people were together from our colleague in South Africa that in the new South African Constitution, corporations are written in as citizens. Now, the American Revolution, what was it? One of the things that it was, it replaced a dictatorial oppressor with a very different idea, the idea of self-governance, and it sent the idea of the monarchy packing. And we transformed crown corporations, dictatorial crown corporations like the Massachusetts colony and the Virginia colony and the Carolina colony into constitutionalized states. What it was not self-governance and democracy for all. So that even though sovereignty passed from the king to the people by revolution, once again there was a minority cult tyrannizing the majority. Native people, African Americans, women, men without property, debtors, and the rest of the species and places. Given this great founding violence against humanity, it is logical that the institution of the tyrannizing minority would one day rule again. It didn't take long. Although the word corporation is not mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, although the minority who recognized themselves as people instituted mechanisms to define and limit the corporation with precision, to keep it from political rights and power, by the end of the 19th century, the corporation had waged a counter-revolution, had transformed the laws, and was on its way to becoming, to being, what corporations had been revealed as for the previous 300 years. With the wealth and power, they constitutionalized corporate rights and authority over property and over the decision-making of what counts. In other words, they became able to act as legal persons and created the fiction of the market, where investment, production, and work decision-making, the basic decision-making that shape our lives and our communities, were declared beyond the authority of the people. So that even when the excluded classes of people, African Americans, Native people, women, men without property, after a century of struggle had become people, had won their rights, the corporations and the culture were powerful enough, the corporate culture was powerful enough to transform all of us into consumers. I go through this because it's vital in our road to consciousness and in our engaging and authentic action to understand that what corporations are now doing around the world, they accomplished in the United States of America 100 years ago. And what they have been perfecting all through this century in this country is what they are seeking to do globally today. What else is GATT or NAFTA or the MI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investments, but the logical next step to constitutionalize the corporation everywhere, through guile to legalize the property rights of corporations over everything that really counts? Given this reality and given this history, we need to ask ourselves critically, what is the nature of our alleged democracy in this country today? Can we say that we have a democracy? Can we say that we, the people, are politically free, that we govern ourselves when corporate fictions not only wield power and authority under law, but they also have oppressed so many people into unconsciousness? When we gather to talk about our goals, how can we gather to teach each other to meet as political equals, as aspiring to nothing less than political freedom? To recognize today that today the giant corporation is illegitimate, that we must not concede to the corporation any authority, that we must understand how they have colonized our minds, lowered our aspirations, confused us about who we are and what we can be. The late 19th century populists refused to concede to the corporation authority over their lives. They refused to concede that the corporation, this artificial entity created by the people, would become the dominant institution of society. They understood that if the corporation has turned the law around and the culture around so that property rights are greater than human rights, there can be no such thing as self-governance. But that was the last social movement to be so conscious, to be so clear. The progressives, the New Deal, and ever since, our citizen movements essentially have conceded corporate power, basic power and privilege and authority to the corporation, to this form of property. Most citizen efforts have been to tinker with corporate behavior at the margins, not to address their nature. We've tried to curb corporate excesses to perfect the market. Most efforts against corporations in this century have been against the symptoms of corporate domination, and they have taken place in the dens created by corporations to absorb our time and energy, regulatory administrative agencies, and the corporate press. But these are not the arenas of sovereignty, of citizen authority, of our political freedom. Given the constitutional rights which federal courts have given the corporations, and given our powerful corporate culture, these realms are stacked deck proceedings where people, communities, and nature are fundamentally disadvantaged. Here we cannot demand, by what authority has Corporation X acted as an oppressor of the sovereign people? Here we cannot declare a corporation beyond its authority and declare it null and void and dismantle it. We must grapple with the reality that today our law and culture concede sovereignty to these artificial entities called corporations. And we must grapple with the fact that so do most of our own citizen organizations, our organizations created to bring about justice and environmental protection and protect worker rights and human rights. So we endlessly tally corporate acts, we analyze the regulatory agencies, we become expert in every issue under the sun. But we don't study who we the people are and how we got into this mess and how it is our responsibility to free ourselves so that we can define all the corporate bodies that we create, business, government, civic, education. We've been resisting corporate assaults one at a time, after the fact, and over and over and over again. It's enough. It's time to build a cosmic democracy movement, a movement for political rights and for real self-government. It's time for us to be socially responsible. It's time for us to be accountable. But we are not accountable or responsible when we create these monster robots which run rampant in our communities and which in our name sally forth across the world to wreak havoc upon other places and upon other people's self-governance. We are not being socially responsible or civically accountable when we don't act like self-governing people. We are not being socially responsible or civically accountable when we play in the corporate arenas and obey corporate rules. We are not being socially responsible or civically accountable when we permit our agents in government to bestow our sovereignty upon machines. We're not being socially responsible or civically accountable when we organize our communities and then go to corporate executives and to the hacks who run the corporate front groups and ask them, please, please, cause a little less harm, or when we offer them even more rewards for being a little less dominating and oppressing. Sovereign people do not beg of or negotiate with the subordinate entities that we create. Sovereign people, self-governing people, instruct subordinate entities. Self-governing people define all the entities we create. And when a subordinate entity violates the terms of its creation and undermines our ability to govern ourselves and violates the fundamentals of a body politic, we are required to move in responsibly and accountably to cut this cancer out of the body politic. We make all our struggles for justice and democracy here and around the world easier by weakening the ability of corporations to make the rules, to set the culture, and to oppress us. With such deeds, will we honor the millions of people who struggled before us to wrest power from tyrants and to define themselves in the face of terror and oppression. Thank you.
That was Richard Grossman, recorded in Washington, D.C. at the 1996 teach-in organized by the International Forum on Globalization. This is a tribute to his still largely unknown work. Richard died on November 22, 2011. He lived with his wife, Mary MacArthur, in a small town in the Catskills in New York State. His lasting legacy is the pamphlet Taking Care of Business, written with contribution by Frank Adams, published in 1993. In that pamphlet, Grossman laid out for the first time the history, subversion, and the taking back of the process of chartering corporations. Grossman wrote, "When we look at the history of our states, we learn that citizens intentionally defined corporations through charters. In exchange for the charter, a corporation was obligated to obey all laws, to serve the common good, and to cause no harm. Early state legislators wrote charter laws to limit corporate authority and to ensure that when a corporation caused harm, they could revoke its charter. Corporations may have taken our political power, but they have not taken our constitutional sovereignty. Citizens are guaranteed sovereign authority over government officeholders. Every state still has legal authority to grant and to revoke corporate charters. Corporations, large or small, still must obey all laws, serve the common good, and cause no harm. To exercise our sovereign authority over corporations, we must take back our political authority over our state governments. Our right to charter corporations is as crucial to self-government as our right to vote. Both are basic franchises, essential tools of liberty." End quote from Taking Care of Business by Richard Grossman, a slender pocketbook of 32 pages filled with practical advice, bibliography, and footnotes. The booklet is out of print. A link to the text on Dave Radcliffe's website is on tucradio.org. It is an amazingly timely resource. There are two important projects that Richard Grossman initiated in the last months of his life. Upstate New York, where he lived in a small town, was in the crosshairs of natural gas exploration and hydrofracking. Fracking involves injecting highly toxic chemicals deep underground to fracture rock formations to force out the gas. Fracking has been linked to groundwater contamination across the U.S., including many cases where people can actually set their tap water on fire. The process is currently unregulated, due to exemptions in law. Richard Grossman became active in the Sovereign People's Action Network, SPAN. He presented at the August 2011 Greenfest in New York City the draft of a law to not just regulate or limit the practice, but to formally criminalize the procedure. The draft of this criminalized fracking law is an amendment to the Penal Code and dated August 2011. A link to this draft is posted on the newest programs page of TUC Radio's website. The second legacy of Richard Grossman's work that he formalized as draft just 4 weeks before he died is an act to criminalize chartered incorporated business entities as a class or group. Several obituaries refer to that act by name without offering a link to the text. It seems as if those who want to remember Richard Grossman shy away from presenting his most radical proposal. But Richard himself wanted it to be seen. It is his contribution to the Occupy movement. He sent an email with a draft with permission to share to friends and colleagues just a few weeks before he died. TUC Radio and I received it on October 23, 2011. It said, "Autumnal greetings, Mariah. I sent this around the other week. If you can help spread, I'd much appreciate it." His cover letter said, "At Wall Street and other occupations, there's much talk of greed and corruption. Historical, constitutional, and legal analyses, as well as evaluations of past people's strategies and organizings, are skimpy. For people prepared to move beyond greed and corruption, see below an act to criminalize chartered incorporated business entities. Why not target USA and state law that has long enabled minority rule, that has constitutionalized violence against peoples and the earth? Could be energizing, keeping in mind, of course, that there is no quick fix, so we'll have to be creative, persistent. Feel free to circulate. The time is ripe. Good luck to us all and to the earth. In solidarity, Richard." That was the cover for Richard Grossman's email that I received 4 weeks before he died. The act to criminalize chartered incorporated business entities is a passionate, learned, and moving provocation. Setting July 4th, 2012 as date, it says that on that day, quote, "All existing business corporation charters granted by the United States and by all states shall be null and void." And on that same date, owners of stock in previously incorporated business entities and entity directors and executive officers shall forever be liable for all debts, liabilities, assaults, denials, harms, invasions, and usurpations committed by any and all successor business entities, end quote. There's more specific formal legal language that is too difficult to read on air. However, the attached notes form the essence of Richard Grossman's thinking and are his legacy to the movements for self-governance and occupation that began in 2011. That was a tribute to some of Richard Grossman's work. He died of cancer on November 22, 2011. In the last 15 years, he had been an important member of POCLAD, the Project on Corporations, Law and Democracy, and CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. For links to the texts mentioned in this program, come to www.tucradio.org. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order a CD of Richard Grossman on Dismantling Corporations by calling 1-707-463-2654. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654. For information on how to order, you can get your CD by mail or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.
Radio Curious, I'm Barry Vogel. Gene expression, psychosocial and cultural genomics, a healing process that connects the mind, body to emotional and physical healing is our topic. Our guest is Dr. Ernest Rossi, a practicing psychologist, hypnotherapist, and expert in dreams. Dr. Rossi describes how we humans can activate a specific gene within us to advance our abilities or recover from an injury. He suffered a major stroke in the early 2000s that severely impaired his speech and movement. Dr. Rossi managed his own recovery using psychosocial and cultural genomics. His website is ErnestRossi.com. He and I visited at the 11th Milton Erickson Psychotherapy Congress in Phoenix, Arizona, in December 2011. We began when I turned on the recorder and asked Dr. Rossi to explain how gene expression works.
It's a fascinating new concept. You know, genetics has been in existence for about 200 years since Gregor Mendel founded the field. But Gregor Mendel was interested in genes as a unit of heredity. So most science writers are really dealing with that ancient, original concept of genetics as heredity going from one generation to another. The popular imagination says that genes are the units of heredity. They are fixed traits. Just within the past generation, we've learned a new function of genes. There are some genes called activity-dependent genes. These genes only turn on when there's certain activities in the environment, like you're asking me questions, that will start turning on gene expression so I can make the proteins, to make the neurotransmitters, make the hormones, so that I can give you an appropriate response.
Activity-dependent genes would include a wide range of behavior, from listening to music to being physically or emotionally abused.
Exactly. It could be positive or negative. And what we've just learned is that thoughts turn on RNA, that's ribonucleic acid, and that ribonucleic acid at the cellular level travels to the nucleus of the cell where the chromosomes and the genes are and tells the gene to turn on or turn off. For any observable behavior, there are probably hundreds, thousands of genes that are in a coordinated activity, families of genes. And all these genes have individual variations. Darwin says that random variation and natural selection are the two dynamics that make evolution work. At the molecular level, the genetic level, there's always constant changes that are taking place, just as a function of temperature, pressure. Each gene has many forms. Theoretically, we have about 20,000, 25,000 genes, but these genes are made up of put long, complicated DNA molecules. It's almost like a little step ladder. Each step of the ladder is a base, and it's the characteristic that together makes up the genes. Well, in Darwinian evolution, often those letters are mixed up, and each mix-up can give a different flavor to how the gene expresses itself. So if you have 25,000 genes, but each of those genes could have hundreds of different letters, you see it's 25 times hundreds, actually millions, yes, variations of different genes. Different people will respond to the same stimulus in different ways because they've all got different variations of their genes. There's no two people, even identical twins, will have spontaneous variations happening every day.
I'd like to see if we could put this in two separate categories.
Separate categories.
One is the category of learning language.
Yes.
When the genes that we have are particularly susceptible to being turned on at a young age to learn multiple languages.
Yes.
Versus turning on a gene to get out of an emotional crisis.
Yes.
That may not be age limited as much as language.
Right.
Can you address those differences?
Stress is something that we all experience when we experience a trauma, a great surprise. And that stress can turn on and turn off different sets of genes. So that if your stress is continuous, for example, it can actually turn off the genes that make the proteins that make a part of the brain called the hippocampus learn. The hippocampus will actually shrink with continuous stress, and that person who has a shrunken hippocampus will find it very difficult to learn a new thing like language or a musical instrument. A lot is related to how you're experiencing life, your lifestyle, so to speak. Lifestyle, whether you have a relaxed life or, say, a high-pressure life, can determine which hormones are flowing through your system, whether these hormones support brain growth, neurotransmitters that increase the efficacy of your synaptic connections and increase your IQ. The general idea is try to live a good life, a life where you have relaxation at several times throughout the day. We now know, for example, every hour and a half or two, there's a complete cycle from mind, cognition, behavior, communicating to genes and turning on certain genes and turning off certain genes. So if a complete cycle takes place every 2 hours, then in a typical 24-hour period, you experience 12 creative periods. Most people don't even think of themselves as creative, but the mind-body is continually working on problems in the background. This is what the so-called unconscious is. Now the unconscious isn't just a metaphor. Now we know the unconscious is this process of stimuli coming in from the outside world. If they're interesting and they may turn on gene expression and give rise to new thoughts, new creative thoughts. This is what we call brain plasticity. The brain actually grows, builds new neural networks, and these new neural networks are the organic structure of what new levels of consciousness actually are.
Putting this into a Darwinian perspective, now we're in the beginning of the second decade of the 21st century on the Gregorian calendar, the Christian calendar. But if we go back way before the Christian calendar, go back 10,000 years, genetically we would be able to procreate with a person from that era, getting the time together.
Yeah.
But you talk about stress, at that time, life was not necessarily as easy as it is now.
Much in terms more hazardous than today.
In terms of potable water, in terms of shelter, in terms of public health.
Much more difficult.
The stress level, in my assumption, is that it was much greater at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts on the evolutionary process that has occurred, even going back more than 10,000 years, maybe to 70,000 when we first walked out of Africa?
How about going back 13.7 billion years to the Big Bang?
That's fine. Let's go there.
Okay, let's go there. Okay, at that point, this is the quantum universe. What's characteristic of the quantum universe is even before matter is created, in the emptiness of cosmic space, the so-called cosmic vacuum. Even in a vacuum, quantum particles are spontaneously popping into existence and popping out. That's the nature of the quantum universe. Okay, gradually come forward in time to 4.7 billion years ago. At that time, temperatures began settling down, and we can imagine a primitive Earth. What happened around 4.7 billion years ago was what we call RNA world. The world was made of the so-called ribonucleic acid molecule, and that was a very active kind of a molecule. We might almost say it was a nervous molecule. A lightning bolt hits a part of the ocean at one point, and the RNA will immediately transmit that electrical energy around the globe in chaotic various directions. That's one part of how life became what it is. But according to Darwinian evolutionary theory, random mutations are always taking place. And one day, we believe it's around 5 billion years ago, the RNA got a mutation that changed it to DNA. DNA means there's two oxygen molecules instead of nitrogen and oxygen of the RNA. The behavior of the DNA molecule is profoundly different than that of the nervous RNA. DNA is naturally more stable. So once it gets a certain formation, it can transmit itself when it replicates from generation to generation. When cells finally formed, they were a combination of DNA genes, as we now know them, that can transmit their characteristics from one generation to another. They also had a surrounding tire, you might say, of RNA. Now remember, the RNA was a very nervous, it was specialist in transmitting energy and molecular codes. The RNA became the signaling system from the outside world into the nucleus to the DNA. So we now have the scenario, RNA is taking signals from the outside world, transmitting it to the DNA. It changes the expression of the DNA, so the DNA makes different proteins that lead to different nerves, different cell types. So now these genes are activity dependent upon the activities of the outside world, are transmitted through the RNA to the DNA, and the DNA, in effect, tries to make proteins and structures that are going to adapt in a creative way to the changing circumstances of the outside world. Philosophers call this the mind-body problem. How can something as insubstantial as mind influence the body? For example, in psychosomatic medicine, you experience psychological traumas. It's only on a mental level, and yet you start getting very real symptoms in your physical body. This is how it's done. The mental stimuli will turn on certain genes, activity-dependent gene expression, the biologist calls it. And if they're not adaptive, if they're not giving a true signal, and if the genes do not know how to adapt, then we start getting malformations. In addition to that, as you go from a young child that learns very well because its genes are fresh and new and they don't have malformations, as we progress in age, we start experiencing cellular oxidation. What's that supposed to mean?
Before you answer that question, I'd like to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Dr. Ernest Rossi, who is the keynote speaker at the 11th International Congress on Ericksonian Approaches to Psychotherapy. This interview was recorded in Phoenix, Arizona, on December 11th, 2011. This is Radio Curious, and I'm Barry Vogel. Dr. Rossi, the question is gene expression and turning it on later in life after there is cellular oxidation.
Cellular oxidation means that your genes are burning up. You know, life is a process of combustion. We put together phosphorus and certain molecules with oxygen, and we really combust, we burn. And in that process of burning, that's how we get energy. Chemists call it ATP, adenosine triphosphate. It's the chemical that releases energy for all your body activities. However, as we get older, more and more of the gene structures start wearing away, all those steps in the ladder of the helix that makes up our life code. As they wear away, life becomes more precarious because the genes don't function with efficiency. So just this moment, a moment ago, I forgot within a couple seconds what I was talking about. You have to remind me. I'm a guy who's 78 years old. Most people my age start complaining about their lack of memory. What's that about? Cellular oxidation. 78 years of burning up, making the energy to drive my body, but at the same time, an unfortunate side effect, burning up some of the delicate gene structures so that they're no longer efficient in creating memory and learning.
I'd like to ask a little more about you.
About me?
Yes.
I should be a subject of interest to Curious Radio?
I'm a curious guy. I like to ask about you, the man behind the ideas.
Okay.
And how you've been able to learn the theories that you're talking about to assist yourself in changing from what I understand is commonly called a stroke that you had a number of years ago.
My goodness. Well, I can tell you an interesting story. When I had my stroke, I was like in my late 60s. One manifestation of a stroke was my speech was slurred. Even now, if you listen to my speech carefully, you'll notice I have little hesitancies. That's still part of stroke behavior. But how did I recover from my stroke? Well, all cells of the body, tissues of the body, even brain tissues, has what we call stem cells, the very same stem cells that there's so much political controversy. Should we use these stem cells?
And those are the cells that allow a certain organ to reproduce.
Yes.
As opposed to being skin versus heart muscle versus
right.
Eye muscle.
When I had a stroke, that meant that certain brain cells died because a blood vessel broke accidentally, and it essentially drowned some of the cells, my brain tissue. And as those normal, good, healthy neurons died, their last act was to send out a bevy of molecular signals into the surrounding tissues. These were molecular messengers telling stem cells that were distributed randomly throughout my brain, hey, stem cells, turn on your gene expression and start reproducing me. start reproducing my functions. So you can imagine a conversation happening between a dying cell and the stem cells, which are like kind of embryonic. They're like little babies. They don't have a function yet. They have only one function. When they receive signals that a legitimate, mature brain cell is dying, and the message coming from that dying cell is, replace me, I'm dying. How does it replace the dying cell? The stem cell has to turn on its genes to start making the proteins that are going to replicate. If it's a brain cell that dies, it has to become a brain cell. If you have a heart attack and it's a heart cell that dies, the message coming from the injured heart cells is, replace me. And now the message is to make another heart cell, meaning another pattern of genes has to turn on. That's activity-dependent gene expression. Every tissue, every organ of the body expresses different sets of genes, families of genes, and it's the difference in the proteins they produce that give identity to a brain cell or a heart cell.
Were you able to make any conscious effort to turn on these cells in you?
Yes and no. Let me tell you what we know about the process. I had a series of dreams. You know, I'm a specialist in dreams. One of my first books I ever published back in 72 was Dreams and the Growth of Personality. Now it's in its third edition. But what that book was all about was when we experience something novel, new, or surprising in the outside world, that new impulse turns on our hippocampus, it learns it, and then when we go to sleep, the hippocampus has a dialogue, a talk with the cortex of our brain, our consciousness. When we first go to sleep, we go deeply into deep wave sleep. What is deep wave sleep? Well, it's the cortex starting a dialogue with the hippocampus. The cortex says, hey, anything new happened in the world for your experience that I should know about, because if something new happened, I want to make new proteins, I want to make new neural networks to encode this new change in your environment. So this is how the brain continually updates itself. Well, we were talking about me, my stroke, and did I do anything to consciously help myself with conscious suggestions to replace the dying cells? I said yes and no. I'll tell you the very first dream I had the day I had a stroke. I dream at night, I'm driving a car over a dangerous overpass, and I suddenly want to put on the brakes, but I can't because my right leg is somehow paralyzed. Well, that was in fact the case. Not only was my speech slurred, but my right side was partially paralyzed. So the dream was starting to work on this new and novel, and in this case, tragic body condition. And I suddenly go lucid in my dream. I suddenly realize that I'm dreaming. And if I watch, it might show me a picture of my own brain, and I can see where my stroke is. Well, to make a long story short, as it comes closer, I see it's a wire mesh of my own head going around in a circular pattern, such that, hey, if I really look at it carefully, I can tell what part of my brain the stroke is in and be able to guide myself. Well, with that exciting thought, it woke me up, and I say, oh, shucks, I just missed it. The dream ended before I could find where the stroke location was. With that came tears of thankfulness. This dream had profound meaning to me. Even though I'm hampered, I'm struggling with a stroke-injured brain, something is working correctly. So I knew immediately my highest functions, self-reflection, was still struggling and still capable of operating. And that gave me the sense of hope. Oh, even though my arm's paralyzed, my leg's paralyzed, my speech is slurred. Something in me is reporting my condition inaccurately. And that gave me the courage when I woke up. Yes, I'm going to practice exercises of my wife actually bought me a piano. I never played the piano before. By relearning hand-eye coordination, I was starting to exercise my brain to turn on the genes that would make the proteins that would repair the dying, stroke, hurt cells. So now consciousness comes in, and even my mental rehabilitation workers, they would give me little tasks of putting one little metal piece on another, and it was very difficult to do because my hand is partially paralyzed. I would laugh, and mental rehabilitation workers would say, "Geez, you're really surprising. Most patients are depressed when they see their functioning is so primitive." And I said, if I can do this, I know it's going to turn on my genes and it's going to reconstruct my brain. And they didn't know what I was talking about. And I said, well, you see, I wrote this book. And just before I had the stroke, I had sent this manuscript of the psychobiology of gene expression. And I said, someday the book is not out yet, but you'll read about it. And this I know, I love these exercises because I know they're giving me the right exercise that's going to turn on my genes, that's going to make new repairs on my brain. So naturally I love it. And the therapists were all like, Dr. Rossi, if that's what you're doing, yes, you're absolutely right. You just... And I said, you don't believe me, you guys. You haven't read my book. We're going to read it, Dr. Rossi. You just keep doing what you're doing. My own theory I use to help myself. That, Barry, is the essence of my message today.
And it seems like you were successful watching you speak in front of a group of 500 people, talking with you now, watching you move your arms and walk at other times. It's a wonderful thing.
It's a wonderful world. I'll never complain again.
Well, Dr. Ernest Rossi, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious here in Phoenix, Arizona.
It's truly been a pleasure.
And before we close, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. And the first one is, can you tell us about an aha or eureka moment, and you may just have done that changed your life?
Right. It was that moment in my dream when I recognized, aha, I've got a stroke, my brain is damaged, but higher functions are still trying to operate and they're succeeding. I'm going to pursue these exercises. That was my big aha. And I think that's why I didn't get depressed. Simple exercise can actually help us return on gene expression to recover rehabilitation.
And it appears that you're a living example. If you can do it, there's no reason why somebody else cannot.
Absolutely not.
So tell me, what would you like to do with the rest of your one precious life?
Continue this marvelous study. I'm a psychotherapist, so I can work with people who had stroke and a lot of disability. But even more than that, I've been inspired to do research on gene expression. Even something as simple as exercise can be a marvelous prescription for a lot of people who have just psychological problems, because psychological problems can be rehabilitated by turning on gene expression simply through physical exercise as well as mental exercise.
And finally, Dr. Ernest Rossi, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
I tell you what, make it simple. You got a computer, a browser, something like Google, just put in Ernest Rossi, my homepage, and there you'll see many of the 36 books that I've written or edited. You make your own choice depending upon what you need.
Dr. Ernest Rossi, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Okay, you're an inspiration yourself, Barry, your smiling face.
Dr. Ernest Rossi is a practicing psychologist, psychotherapist, and hypnotherapist who lives on the Central Coast of California. The book he recommends would be your choice of the 36 books he has authored or edited. For more information about his books and his work, you may visit his website, ErnestRossi.com.
There are over 500 archive editions of Radio Curious on our website, www.radiocurious.org. You may reach us by email, curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our associate producer, and I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.